Now, who is Judd? A psychiatrist. Now, it's quite natural that he should read books on the history of old religious societies. But why should Mrs. Reddy, a woman with a beauty parlor?
I don't know.
That's just it. And this figure, she traced it. The book I saw at the library had been marked perfect by the library inspector in March. Mrs. Reddy had it out in April, and no one else had read it since. This figure is the symbol of the Pilatists.
It's all clear to me now. So clear.
I thought it would be, but just to be sure, I'll tell you that the Pilatists are a society of devil worshippers.
Devil worshippers?
Look, look, I'm serious. It's a very real and earnest society, a dangerous society.
I can imagine.
1,000 years after the death of Christ, money changers, those who loan out and manipulate the quantity of money, were active in medieval England. In fact, they were so active that acting together, they could manipulate the entire English economy. These were not bankers per se. The money changers generally were the goldsmiths. They were the first bankers because they started keeping other people's gold for safekeeping in their vaults. The first paper money was merely a receipt for gold left at the goldsmith. Paper money caught on because it was more convenient than carrying around a lot of heavy gold and silver coins. Eventually, goldsmiths noticed that only a small fraction of the depositors ever came in and demanded their gold at any one time. Goldsmiths started cheating on the system. They discovered that they could print more money than they had gold, and usually no one would be the wiser. Then they could loan out this extra money and collect interest on it. This was the birth of fractional reserve banking. That is, loaning out many times more money than you have assets on deposit. So, if $1,000 in gold were deposited with them, they could loan out about $10,000 in paper money and draw interest payments on it, and no one would ever discover the deception.
It's Friday. It's just after 5 p.m. and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday, the 15th of September, 2022, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft Arts Centre in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream and at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. Also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please don't use Google, though. That is the Google Play Store. Avoid that at all costs. There are quite a lot of, like the Telegram app, that Google won't put on there unless it's got certain dodgy things in it. So don't use Google. Story about that also coming up in a minute, about Google and finally some sort of quite serious antitrust case against Google over in the United States, anti-monopoly case. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military-grade propaganda, psyops, the puff pieces on the conspirators, and the hatchet jobs on the heroes. So also joining us is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. This week we're going to be running through quite a lot of local and national stuff, including some guests coming in to talk about forcing people with no money whatsoever to pay council tax. I suppose Margaret Thatcher will be rubbing her hands in her grave, and also will be Victor Rothschild, who put her up to, along with William Waldegrave, put her up to the old poll tax and the council tax concept. So we'll be looking at Monkton Wild. This is this community that's under attack down near Lyme Regis. We'll be looking at that Google antitrust case I mentioned. There's something called the Troubles Bill about Northern Ireland, which I'm sure Martin will have plenty to say about, which is trying to exonerate those people involved in collusion within the British Army and various forms of Northern Ireland terrorism. Fascinating topic, which exposes a lot about what the Troubles were really all about. The council tax reduction, we'll be looking at that along with the local April branch. The idea of Camilla, this is the Queen now, she calls herself, even though the former Queen Elizabeth II said that she should be called Queen Consort because of the illegal marriage that took place, which the Queen didn't attend, between Charles and Camilla. And Camilla actually approved Toby Andre as Charles's press secretary. Interesting idea that, you know, this is an article from the Times this week about how Camilla's really in charge of that relationship, which is a bit weird, a bit worrying. And also Rishi Sunak's implication in the school's rat scandal, and that scandal possibly extending to the British Armed Forces as well. In part two, we look at the cruise missile attack in Crimea by the Ukrainians, supposedly. I didn't know they actually made cruise missiles. I wonder where they got those from to attack the Russian fleet in Simferopol, I think it's called, the Russian base in Crimea. Echoes of the Crimean War and Winston Churchill and the rest of them. Also, we'll be having our second of the Donbass Voices series. We had Andre, can't remember his second name, Andre, anyway, he was a trade union leader from the Donbass. Another Donbass voice, this one's a doctor, Erie Bell, who's now working in London from the Donbass, gives her view on what's going on in Ukraine. We have Boris in Ukraine and a very special guest who I know Martin will love to hear from. And that is Christopher Steele. He's a former MI6 officer. The BBC seem to love putting him on the TV, so we'll see what he's got to say about Ukraine. Also, of course, the Libyan floods and the Moroccan earthquake, as well as the G20, the announcement there, and a bit about election fixing in the United States, which is not being done by Russia, but being done by forces within the Democratic Party. Finally, we finished with Rise this week inside the Lucis Trust. So Iranian and Russian news banned in the UK, first by the telecoms cartels and then by Ofcom, and us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia, but not actually cancelled here yet, thank goodness. Anyway, Martin, let's start with this story about the Merchant Ventures, because they have a long history, don't they, of taking over schools, the academy schools in the Bristol area.
Yeah, I mean, they started doing it some while ago. They set up two schools historically. Edward Colston, who was a merchant venturer, set up Colston Boys' School and Colston Girls' School, which were private schools for many years. Colston Girls' School became part of the state system after the crash in 2008. And, of course, they've now changed the name to Montpellier Academy. And on the back of that, when the academy system came in, they then took over various schools in Bristol, which had failed or fallen into special measures or whatever. And so they started empire building both primary and secondary schools. And I've worked in some of the schools that they manage.
Now, did you notice any difference in the way that they were run? Let's just explain. The Merchant Venturers are this historic organisation constituted under a royal charter in the 14th century, and they're not scrutinisable by journalists really at all, and the only people who can scrutinise them is Jacob Rees-Mogg and the Privy Council. They can have a look at their accounts, but nobody else can. So they're a bit of a weird organisation, like a medieval hangover.
They are, and I think they saw the opportunity because they'd got this, what they thought of as a track record in education, because they'd, you know, these two private schools had been set up by them. But of course, they'd had nothing much to do with them in the subsequent years, apart from having, as you know, the Founders' Day event in Bristol Cathedral, where they were all given a hot cross bun and told how wonderful Edward Colston was. And, of course, as you know, eventually the state schools, which have been taken over by them, they all bust in to listen to this eulogy to Edward Colston, which turned out to be rather embarrassing when you recorded it and the BBC ran with it. I can't remember how many schools they've now taken over in Bristol, but in other words, they've become a kind of academy trust which only operates in Bristol. But I understand that they are intending to throw in the towel.
Well, let's not jump the gun, because let's look at Christine Townsend, who's a guest. She's now a Green Party councillor too. She's a former teacher and still works in education, I believe. But anyway, in Bristol 24/7 this week, we've seen on Tuesday an article, Medieval Institution Built on Human Exploitation as No Place Running Schools. And, you know, this is what the Merchant Ventures talk about education. And as you've just pointed out, really, it's miseducation, the idea that the embarrassing role that the merchant venturers played in the slave trade and the exploitation and really genocide of North American Indians back in the 15th, 16th, 17th century is just completely sanitized by these people. In the cathedral, they're saying that the idea that Edward Colston was in any way connected with the slave trade was just speculation. Well, this is a lie. It's not speculation. It's very well proven fact. And so the merchants were really miseducating all those school children in the cathedral that day. Christine Townsend has reiterated her call for the Society of Merchant Venturers to stop their involvement in children's schooling. The Shadow Cabinet Member for Education, she's in the Greens, at Bristol City Council, said the individuals who make an active choice to be members of this medieval institution built on the exploitation and extortion of fellow human beings and the environment are surely the most contemptuous and damaging community in this city. To use a well-worn phrase, in the name of God, go, wrote Christine Townsend in an eviscerating member forum statement ahead of Tuesday's full council meeting at City Hall. Which she stressed was her personal opinion. The years it's taken these people to get out of state schools has seen generations of our city's children subjected to inadequate education, safeguarding risks, being made to engage in ritual worship of slave traders in Bristol Cathedral, their staff being subject to institutional racism, venturers on a school governing body writing supportive character references for a senior staff member who was later found guilty of sexual crimes against a child, continuous unlawful admission practices designed to filter year seven intakes just to get the wealthier pupils in. That's just some of the stuff that has appeared in the press. Only the children and families that attend these schools and were on the receiving end of these people's attitudes and approaches can truly understand the contempt which the merchant venturers treat their working class and the levels of entitlement and arrogance with which they live their lives. Getting out of our state school sector is only the beginning. These people must get out of our democracy entirely. Well, that's the article in Bristol 24/7. I'll put a link up to on our show page. But Martin, she's being pretty forceful there and saying that these people, Christine is saying that they should have absolutely no place in our democracy and our society. But of course they do. They're very, very influential in Bristol still because they're so incredibly wealthy.
Well, that's right. I think it was always a very questionable whether they were appropriate people to run schools. I mean, basically, it's an association of business people. And why should business people be appropriate for running schools? I mean, one of the things they did I can't remember now, it's Withywood, when they took the school over, secondary school, one of the first things they did is, why don't we have an army training corps and we'll build a rifle range to teach them to shoot? And this, of course, came from the attitude that, you know, these kids are quite sort of, you know, plebeian working class people from Hartcliffe and they don't have many opportunities. So we're going to give them opportunities to join the army. And of course, a lot of the parents didn't like that at all. And Neil Maggs, who some of you will know, who was he was the actual business manager of the school, he got a lot of the parents together and they put their foot down and said, well, we're not having this. Why are you imposing this on us? It's because you think of our kids as potential cannon fodder. And they were made to back down over that. But I think shows you why they're inappropriate to run schools.
Clarify, there are two Neil Maggs in Bristol, both of them pretty politically active. The one you've spoken about is not the same as the journalist Neil Maggs, who's interviewed Christine and the merchant. Yeah. And the Green Party councillor's comments also come after pupils at Merchants Academy were told they had to find a new school to do their A-levels just days before term began this year. So they do sound a bit shambolic. They've told all their A-level pupils, sorry, but we won't be able to actually provide you with an A-level education, even though we thought we were going to do that, and we told you we were, before the summer holidays.
Well, if it's just the A-level students, that's shambolic. But, I mean, is the implication of that, Tony, because I haven't followed this news, that they're just packing up and leaving education completely just like that? which seems extraordinary to me. I mean, you've got to wind things down, surely.
This is just the A-level students. A-level students were turned away from a Bristol school days before term started. Pupils were told they had to find a new school to do their A-levels just days before the beginning of term this year.
Yeah.
This is a story on the BBC. Basically what's happened there is Merchants Academy in Withywood has cancelled all its A-level courses due to a lack of numbers. By late August, only 20 pupils were signed up, which would cost too much, the school said. Running any course for two or three children just simply isn't financially viable, said Tristan Williams, Deputy Chief Executive of the Venturers Trust, which runs the school. Does sound pretty shambolic. I mean, this is a poor area of the city, and so there just aren't the numbers of pupils that see if there's any point in carrying on doing A-levels, no matter whether they're able to or not, it seems.
Well, I mean, that was obviously a poor choice to try and set up an independent A-level section of Withywood School. I mean, normally kids from that part of the city would expect, if they're going to do A-levels, to go on to City of Bristol College, which are actually geared up for A-levels. The idea that you know, individual schools can somehow compete with what City of Bristol offer is pretty silly, really.
Also, Bristol 24/7, the local paper, have asked the Society of Merchant Venturers if they will continue their involvement in Montpellier High School, previously Colston Girls' School, once the merger happens, which the organisation believed to own the land the former private school occupies on Cheltenham Road. Bristol 24/7 director Marty Burgess has been a member of the Merchant Venturers since 2019. So this is interesting, isn't it? So you've also got one of the directors of the paper is a Merchant Venturer too. So of course this makes reporting on it quite awkward. We reported a few weeks ago, didn't we, about the Lakota nightclub, which the Bristol 24/7 cannot report on, simply because the Merchant Venturers have one of their people on the board of the paper. Well, of course, this is a tradition in Bristol that the Merchant Venturers are absolutely everywhere.
Well, that's right. I mean, I don't know what's happened with this story. I mean, the idea that you were going to be able to start an A-level sixth form, as we used to call it, part of Withywood School from scratch was obviously, you know, that would have been it's just a silliness. Why is that going to work? And of course, Montpellier High School has changed its name. And of course, the other thing that Christine picks up on is the intake. What happened in Montpellier High School is that Colston Girls' School used to have many girls who were coming in from outside the city limits. They used to come in on the bus and the train or on Range Rover every day. And then when it became a state school, one of the things you're allowed to do is you're allowed to have siblings go to the school, because there's going to be a waiting list, but siblings always get first preferential treatment. So parents that used to pay for their girls to go to the school no longer had to pay for the girls that were going to the school, and their younger sisters got places, which meant that in actual fact, even though it's on Stokes Croft here, one of the most deprived communities in Bristol, it was virtually impossible for a local girl to get a place in the school. And this, of course, is actually selection by the back door without any testing at all. It's just wealthy people clubbing together to make sure that they get the best.
Yeah, sharp elbows. Terrific job, I think, in holding them to account over this. Anyway, the news that you were hinting at, Martin, is today, and that is that the Merchant Venturers schools are to be taken over by a National Academy chain. The controversial Venturers Trust, which runs 8 schools in Bristol, will cease to exist after the merger. So this is the result of a lot of this. I think one of the most high-profile controversial organisations running schools in Bristol is effectively being taken over by a much bigger national multi-academy trust. The Venturers Trust, a partnership of the University of Bristol and the Society of Merchant Venturers, which runs 8 schools in Bristol, has announced its merging with EACT, that's E-ACT, a Kettering-based organisation that runs 28 schools across the country. Well, wouldn't it be interesting if some of the Merchant Venturers were on the board of there, or the merchants had some sort of investment in that trust as well? because they don't tell you where their investments are, where their shareholdings are, all that sort of thing. It's impossible to find out unless you just look at where the merchants. The only way you can really find out where their investments are, you're not allowed to know how much money they've got. Obviously, they have billions. But it is where you see individual merchant venturers who we know are actual members, and they don't have to give us a members list. They give us a members list which may not be complete. And if we see those individuals popping up on a board somewhere, that tells you that the merchants have got enough shares to nominate people onto the board. But that's really the only way you can trace them. Although the details of the merger are yet to be worked out, it appears the move would end the controversial involvement of the Society of Merchant Venturers in state-funded education in Bristol. So in a way, Christina's got her way, Martin, hasn't she?
Well, she's campaigned on this for many years. And, of course, the real problem is that EACT may be, because they're an established academic trust, they may be more competent. I mean, one of the problems for the merchant venturers is they didn't have any background in this. They just presumed they could take it over and it would work.
Like it is that the people who were working for the Venturers Trust, as they will be setting up a new hub, this EACT company in Bristol, may well just swap from being paid by the Merchant Venturers Trust to being paid by EACT and have the same people in the roles.
Well, it may well be, because obviously what you do want when you've got this kind of transfer is you know, for the kids that are in the schools, you want some continuity. So, you know, you don't want a new academic trust taking over and everybody being sacked and we start from scratch and the kids that are in the schools at the time, you know, have to find other places to go and all the rest of it. You do want some continuity. We shouldn't have academic trusts running schools at all. When I was a kid, it would have been unthinkable. But there we are.
Well, why is that?
Well, because the state has a responsibility to educate all children and to allocate resources equally to all children. Academic trusts are hand-me-down copies of private schools. They compete with each other. They try and attract more funding and they won't share resources, for example. One academic trust will not share its playing field with other academic trusts. Whereas what used to happen in the state sector is that the facilities were shared because we're all on the same side and we're all doing the same job. They brought in, just as they did in the National Health Service, the idea of competition. And, of course, many wealthy Tories, they went to private schools in which the competition is enormous. You know, Winchester is at the top of the pile, Eton second, you know, Rugby there, and then you've got Dotheboys Hall down at the bottom. Whereas state schools always used to cooperate. Basically, you know, kids could transfer from one school to another without much fuss, and lots of resources were shared because local education authorities had an overall plan of what provision was going to be best for everybody. And, of course, that was destroyed by the Tories. And we've now got a dog's breakfast of a system that they've created for us.
Yes,
with some schools,
yes.
Some schools supposedly better, oversubscribed, other schools supposedly worse, where resources continuously pulled away from them. And,
yes,
then, of course, you then get sink schools that nobody wants to go to and all of that.
Yeah, it's another form of privatisation. It's rather disgusting, I think, to see adverts for schools. So a school is advertising, trying to sell itself as a really great school, even though it might be failing on the back of buses and things like that. This is the marketisation, isn't it, of our young people's education.
That's right. And my dad was a head teacher in comprehensive schools, and the whole idea that you should have there's naturally competition between schools anyway. And there's, you know, people looking down their noses at some schools and looking up to other schools. That always went on. But you didn't make it worse by one of the things that they did is that the successful schools should have more money, and the unsuccessful schools, when the kids leave, the money goes with them. My dad argued that when this was brought in, we can have competition. It's not really very sensible because it leads to misallocation of resources and people ending up not going where to the local school and all the rest of it. But if you're going to have competition like that, you can go to the more well thought of school and go to a class of 30, or you can go to the less well thought of school and have a class of 15, because the money stays in the school. The money doesn't go with the children. But of course, what the Tories made sure is that the money went with the children. So then they've got enclaves of wealthy schools. I'm working in Frampton Cotterill at the moment. That's a wealthy enclave. And those kids, you know, basically get more resources, and the parents are all, you know, basically, not all of them, but mostly pretty well off. Meanwhile, in the inner city, as people leave a school, the resources go down the drain. So the thing about competition is that people have to fail and be seen to fail. It's treating schools like small businesses. And of course, the kids that are in that school, when it fails, their education is ruined. And that is exactly why you need an overall plan and everybody working together to provide an education for every child at every level.
Absolutely right. And I think what one of the things we should do is drag Christine in to give us some more detail on this, because it's interesting.
It's a big victory for her if she's achieved this.
But it's interesting, they've made this announcement immediately that she's got this condemnation into the council through the council full council meeting. Suddenly they announce, right, we're merging. Anyway, it's fascinating. But another education related story is about an educational trust based down near Lyme Regis called Monkton Wild. It's a community. It's a beautiful old school that was built in the mid-Victorian period with a church built next door to it too, in the hills just north of the coast at Lyme Regis. And it's actually just in the Dorset side, not the Devon side. There's a boundary just around Lyme Regis. And at Monkton Wild, I've been going down there the last few weeks, but I thought I'd let you have a listen to, there was one of the fascinating things about it all was that there was someone from the London Film School actually down there making a film as these trustees, the newly appointed trustees, decided that they were going to eject some of the people who are doing these educational courses at Monkton Wild in a rather draconian fashion. So there was the basics of it is there was a guy turned up as a resident volunteer. He wasn't actually a full member. He was still on probation, but he was making complaints against individuals who'd been there for many years and actually built the place up, the educational side of it, one of whom is the author Simon Fairley, who's someone I've known for many years, since the mid-1990s. The upshot of it is that they've said, the new trustees have said, oh, we're going to evict Simon and we're going to evict various other people who support him, which has obviously sent the educational side of the charity into a tailspin. So there's a sort of irony here in that the people who are actually doing the education at Trust and have been doing it for many years, and all of this is to do with rural skills, a little bit like a kind of private version of the Rural Development Commission, which was back in Salisbury many years ago. That was gotten rid of by the Tories in the mid-late 1990s. But the idea is to preserve some of these country skills. And I myself did a terrific course down there on hand tools over two days. But anyway, this filmmaker's making a film. I won't name her. I think it's maybe a little bit unfair, but she's making a film down there. And here is a little exclusive clip from the film. The film is actually called Wild. It's not WILD, it's WYLDE. And that's what our clip is. It's Wild, WYLD, with no E on the end, sorry. And we'll hear first a little clip from the film itself, which is where we hear from some of the residents, Jill Barron and Simon Fairley, about hearing the news that the trustees who are supposed to be doing managing the education at Monkton Wild have decided that the people who are actually doing the education, they're going to try and evict them. So let's have a listen now to Jill Barron and Simon Fairley, a little extract from this yet-to-be-released film called Wild.
Actually, all of this land once belonged to the people, and it's been taken off them. Dispossessed. I don't know where I'm going to find another view like this one, you know. I mean, 13 years, this is my 14th spring on this spot, and I know exactly what's going to happen when the season's changing, you know, and all of these colours, and there's a purpley bit over there that goes purple quite soon, and then autumn, and then it all thins out again, and you can see for miles. And this is another rocking chair memory for when I'm 90. I'll pretend I'm sitting here, still looking out of my door and eating biscuits.
A rake would be good.
A rake.
Do you think you'll ever win against the forces of capitalism?
No. No, you're fighting a continual losing battle.
So is there hope?
Well, there's hope, but I mean, it's like a sort of Manichaean battle between good and evil. It just carries on, and but they've got all the power on they've got all the money and the power on their side. So you're fighting a kind of subversive rearguard guerrilla action, really. And anyway, either you did win, you become like them. So there is no prospect of winning. It's just keeping something sane alive while the forces of Babylon remain in control. But of course the forces of Babylon are going to be taken over by artificial intelligence and computers. Eventually they'll do it all, I imagine. But I won't be around to see that, so.
So what should we do?
I'll fight the good fight.
Even though there's no hope of winning?
No, but the hope is just keeping the flag flying and keeping little pockets of resistance going in places like this.
So that's Simon Fairley there, and before him Jill Barron, two of the editors of The Land magazine, which is a magazine I've written for several times in the past, and writing about land rights. Simon's magazine comes out twice a year. And of course, the base for the magazine is also going to go if they actually get evicted. So, terrific cause. And the website that they've put up is Monkton Wild Court Case, Monkton, W-Y-L-D, Court Case, .co.uk. So if you're interested in following what's going on there, they've got a kind of blog where they're putting bits and pieces of information up bit by bit. And the assault is coming from a London magistrate, Martin. This is the bizarre thing, that she's got really no experience of educating rural skills. So how on earth has she ended up as one of these new trustees running the board? It just sounds bizarre.
Well, I mean, you'd have to know about the history of the trust and who set it up and all the rest of it. It's obviously trusts like this have charitable status because they're fulfilling charitable objectives, like education, for example. But if you're going to get rid of the people who actually do it, then maybe you shouldn't have charitable status. But, I mean, I don't know. These kind of political battles are ubiquitous everywhere. You know, there are battles to control Labour Party branches, battles to control trade union branches, and this is a similar sort of thing, isn't it?
What do you make of Simon's description as a Manichaean battle?
Well, I mean, he's saying this, you know, they're the good guys, the other side are the bad guys. That's the sort, you know, it's political rhetoric, isn't it? Of course, he's probably I know Simon. He probably is in the right here. But if you want to have a discussion about Manichaeism, we can, but it's actually a religion, a Middle Eastern religion, and there's quite a lot to say about it, but it's not really to the point.
Okay. I just think it's interesting getting into these terms from time to time. I mean, he's talking really about the general situation being a kind of – he also used the phrase, didn't he, a rearguard action. Is that what we're fighting against, the forces of global capitalism and the elites?
Well, I mean, let's not extrapolate from Monkton Wilde's travails.
Well, what he's saying is that this is something that's going on all over the planet. I mean, I'm sure you.
Well, no, actually, what's happening at the moment is that the global forces against
I'm sure he'd talk about things like, you know, battles being fought by Indian farmers being on a kind of parallel with what's going on with what's happening to them.
Well, yes, I can see that. But in actual fact, the Indian farmers. They didn't entirely win, but they did win. And what's happening on a global scale is that the Western capitalist imperialist system is facing its nemesis. It's not actually a rearguard action. They are the ones who are going to be losing as we go into the next five-year period. That doesn't mean that they won't win little battles against small opponents like the people at Monkton Wild. But the big picture is not looking good for them.
No, it isn't. And I think before we hear the second clip from what's been going on at Monkton Wild, we'll go to look at this G20 that's just finished over in India. because there was something which began just before the G20 called the We20, which was set up by Indians themselves to have a kind of one week. I mean, I'm sure you remember, Martin, we had these things called TOES, which, well, I think it was the other economic summit, which would be happening at the same time as things like the Eurotop and the G20 and the G8 summits. When they,
it was the G7 when it was set up. Yeah.
G7, quite right, before the Russians joined. Let's have a listen now to a clip from the G20, which isn't actually the G20, it's the We20. And here are a bunch of Indians running a parallel people's summit to the G20, something which we hear zero about, of course, on the mainstream press.
India today is burning.
Floods, heat waves, landslides,
farmer suicide, displacement, hunger and poverty.
Post-eviction, demolition, countering public money.
Debt, banking crisis, wealth inequality, privatization.
Targeting minorities, hate speeches, lynchings, parading women naked.
Noisy newsrooms spreading hate, shrinking democratic spaces, violence and impunity.
The same elite club whose prescriptions have negatively impacted rights and liberty and the climate have gathered here again today.
Claiming to save the world using the same logic of the market which puts profits over people.
And in this upside down world, it is this elite club that defines development and decides the fate of millions.
They are proposing austerity in these difficult times.
They propagate the myth of trickle-down, but fill the coffers of the big corporates.
They look at tax breaks for the rich as incentives.
People's voices are being muzzled by the mindless push for economic development and infrastructure at any cost.
This elite G20 club needs to be questioned.
Because the decisions of this informal elite club impacts the global financial architecture.
National economies, functioning of democratic institutions, and most importantly, people's livelihoods, rights and entitlements.
It's crucial that we speak for justice, for equality and for our right to dissent.
A host of people's movements, trade unions, civil society organizations and concerned citizens are coming together.
To raise people's demands and issues at V20, a people's summit on G20. Mark your dates 18th to 20th August 2023. See you there.
So that's a three-day conference, the V20. Great idea. Only trouble is, as announced in very few newspapers, I think there might have been a couple of lines in one or two. The date is the first day of their conference, I think, which is around about the 18th of August. The Indian police stop a meeting. So of the V20, the Indian police stopped a meeting of activists, academics and politicians discussing global issues ahead of a G20 summit, the organisers said. Nearly 400 participants were spending 2 days debating the agenda for the summit of the Group of 20, which will bring together industrialised and developing nations in New Delhi. Most of the issues currently affecting much of the world, including food insecurity, climate change, workers' rights, natural resources and rising inequality, will be on the table. The left-wing We20 meeting also featured speakers who've been vocally critical of the role of Modi's government in hosting the summit, arguing it was using the event to bolster his Hindu chauvinist Bharatiya Janata Party in the run-up to a general election next year. Organisers said they received a letter from New Delhi police telling them to end the meeting. It does not have the correct permission to be held. We are shocked. We need to have permission to practice democracy, they said in a statement. So interesting that they put that little clip out there, Martin, about what they're doing in the We20. And Modi has seen fit to shut the meeting down. So to really, this is quite a serious attack on democracy. And also, of course, he wants to make sure that the G20 helps him win a general election, and he doesn't have any kind of criticism. It's an absolute abuse of power.
Well, he's known for this kind of thing. And of course, the main leader of the opposition in India is Rahul Gandhi. And he has been accused of, I think it's libelling the Prime Minister, and therefore he's been sent to prison, I think, and he can't stand in the election, a bit like Imran Khan in Pakistan.
Modi
is in a much stronger position. In a way, his strong-arm tactics, I suppose what it does is it makes his hard-line supporters support him more. He has got political support. I mean, he's been a very successful politician, and you'd have hoped that somebody with that level of support would be more willing to just tolerate criticism, but it's not his style and it never has been.
So organisers said the police tried to disrupt the WE20 meeting by preventing people from reaching the venue, but the programme went on as scheduled. I'll put a link up to that Morning Star article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So anyway, on a couple of weeks to the... it was a great idea to have this counter conference just a couple of weeks before the G20 itself. So let's have a listen now to Al Jazeera's report on the G20, which ended earlier this week.
I'm in the media centre of the G20, and it's beginning to empty out. That's because the proceedings here have come to an end, and formally the G20 has been handed over for next year, the gavel handed over to Brazil, which will be holding the G20 summit next year in November in Rio. President Biden has left here, he's on his way to Vietnam, all the other leaders are preparing to leave. What have they achieved here? Well, there was a declaration, even though Russia at one point had threatened to block a final declaration if it had the language on Ukraine that it didn't like. Well, they did a fudge here. There wasn't any language that Mr. Lavrov could object to, and he and the Russians said that the final declaration was balanced. That's because they simply put a reference to last year's final declaration or communique and said that we recall what we said last year in Bali. That's something I'm sure the US and its Western allies didn't really like to do, but they wanted to get other things done. The G20, mainly an economic body, that's what the G20 was set up for, and they've certainly got references to the idea that there should be debt relief. They've got references to inequality reform of the global financial system, but experts say there are no plans of action, there are no exact timelines, and in fact Oxfam, the international aid agency, said what was achieved here at the G20 was uninspiring and underwhelming.
Uninspiring and underwhelming. So, I mean, I think it's almost echoing what you were just saying, Martin, that the G20's days are numbered.
Yeah, well, the G20 was set up as a way of trying to, the G7 used to be literally the wealthy countries, a little club. The G20 was created as a kind of consolation club where other emerging countries, in terms of economics, like Brazil and India and China and so on, could be included. And the problem with the G20 as it now stands is it's split between the pro-Western members and the others, who are basically orientating themselves towards this new BRICS organisation. And I think it's quite significant that neither Putin nor Xi attended this summit. And that's basically sending a signal that neither Russia nor China takes this as serious as they used to do, because they've now got other formats where they can talk to more, they can talk to people that they want to talk to, as they did in South Africa not long ago.
Yes, they've sidestepped the Western institutions, it seems.
Yes, and I think the G20's fundamental problem is that it's made up of both of the big forces that are at work in the world are represented in it, and therefore it could be a place where deals were done. But the situation is such that it's deadlocked. So what happened on the Ukraine is that the Russians and their allies said, we're not having any nastiness about that. You'll have to keep that out of it. And the West had to give into that if they wanted any communique at all.
This is quite embarrassing for the West. I mean, they still do talk about the statements made by people like the G7 as the international community. There is still an attempt by the West to make out that the West has still got this kind of, it represents the whole world.
It is, and Lukashenko in Belarus has come up with an interesting formulation of this. He said, "Well, you've got the West, and then you've got the global globe, which is everybody else." And it's increasingly clear that the Western powers, the Europeans, the Americans, and the Australians, the New Zealanders, are actually talking to themselves. Nobody else is in their camp. That doesn't mean that the rest of them have completely switched sides either. What's happened is nobody has to kowtow to the West anymore. Loads of countries, for example, have refused to put any sanctions on Russia. All of these countries, none of the BRICS countries, nobody outside Western Europe, Canada and Australia and New Zealand. Everybody else has simply refused. Now, of course, what the Americans said and the British is, if you refuse, we're going to put sanctions on you. But because everybody's refused, they can't. So that's an empty threat.
Well, one of the things we were hearing from Lavrov a few months ago was that individual diplomats in various sort of swing countries were being specifically threatened by US diplomats, told, well, you've got a child in an American school, you know what might happen to them. So this is not a very good way to endear yourself to these kind of neutral nations, is it?
No, it's not. And in the past, they were able to get away with it because they were so powerful that nobody dared to challenge them. They can make your life a misery. They really can. If you're a small, relatively poor country, you cannot afford to cross them.
What I'm talking about more is the threats to individual families.
Oh, yes, they've certainly made threats to individual families. John Bolton, for example, when he was working for Trump, and they were thinking of bringing Israel to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, he said, we know where your children live, to the lawyers in the court. He came out with it. And that's because they are gangsters. And everybody in the world, apart from people who are subjected to Western media day in, day out, they know they are gangsters. But because they are gangsters, you have to be very careful about when you defy them. But we've now reached a point, with what's happened in the Ukraine and everything, where the whole world is thumbing their noses at them. And that's very dangerous. Because once people don't fear you anymore, you really are in trouble.
Well, Rishi Sunak on the bridge of the unsinkable aircraft carrier, he's not thumbing his nose. Well, I mean, he's just a bought individual.
Not.
But anyway, let's go back to the saga at Monckton Wilde. The website is monctonwildcourtcase.co.uk, and that's WYLD, no E, monctonwildcourtcase.co.uk. And let's hear now from the filmmaker about what happened when the trustees, the newly appointed trustees at Monckton Wilde, got to hear that she was down there from the British Film Institute doing a course as a film student from the United States. And she was actually making a film about the whole thing. So let's have a listen to her now.
I had gotten permission from the community to begin a film before this sort of all exploded. When things started to explode, I was there filming, and the trustees got wind of it and freaked out, and they started calling me, and in a very aggressive, harassing sort of way. And then they made a complaint to the director of my school without telling me that they would remove me, that the police would, they would call the police to remove me from the site if they found me filming. So then the rest of the film happened off-site. Unfortunately, these were the rules that the school gave me to continue the film. And I really wanted to interview the trustees, and I think I would love to, you know, use this as a way to get them to actually say what their plan is. Mm. And that's going hopefully still to happen, but I was given strict orders by the school not to involve the trustees because they're very afraid of defamation. So it's been a really, really interesting and a big learning experience for me personally of, like, how to bring my politics and the resistance I want to do through film into the system of legalistic fear and all of that. So that's the long and short of it.
So that's the filmmaker down at Monckton Wilde being told in no uncertain terms of course, the BFI have got their own lawyers. They will be looking at this saying, gosh, you know, yes, they can stop her filming on the premises. Unless there's a very good reason not to, that's basically the way the law works. And so I think in a way what they've done is they've just kind of shot themselves in the foot, actually. That I think is probably what's happened down there. Anyway, like I say, I think fascinating. And that film called Wild, W-Y-L-D, is due to be released early next year. That was just a kind of short version that we heard, and there was quite a lot in there which is potentially legally dodgy, which I wouldn't dream of letting you hear. But anyway, certainly the stuff from Jill and Simon we heard earlier on is quite legitimate and quite normal to hear those sorts of things. Martin, just to go back to this finally, the idea of an educational trust, why would somebody be so interested in a way obsessed about taking it over?
Well, I don't know what the motivations of those who are, you know, doing the dirty work here are. But most, as I said earlier, most of life is a political battle. There are usually at least two sides in any organisation, and you know, there's a constant struggle between different groups to try and steer things in the directions that they want. This is just in microcosm what we've been talking about in macrocosm in the G20 a minute ago, and it's all, you know, it's turtles all the way down, isn't it?
How do you mean?
Well, I mean the ancient Hindu conception was that the world sat on a turtle, and that turtle sat on another turtle, it sat on another turtle, it sat on another turtle. Political struggles, however varied, are ubiquitous, whether at the highest level, the global level, or at the local level. There's always going to be fights about stuff.
Okay, well, let's have a look now at another story. It's the Troubles Bill, the Troublesome Bill, you might call it. But the Troubles were started around about the early 1970s and carried on until the late 1990s in Northern Ireland. Do you want to give us your take, Martin, in a nutshell, on what that was all
about?
Well,
this Troubles Bill has been put forward by the Tories because they were put under enormous pressure by the Daily Mail and others in the Tory press. Because there was a possibility that soldiers serving in Northern Ireland during the Bloody Sunday massacre, for example, might end up being prosecuted. And they definitely didn't want that to happen. And there's, you know, it's a very emotive thing. We've got to pass a bill so that anything that's happened during that period, everybody should just be, it should all just be forgotten about. Now, in actual fact, that was a possibility when the negotiations around the Good Friday Agreement were taking place. Sinn Féin's position has always been, let's have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, like in South Africa, where everybody can come forward and say what they were doing, whether they're in the IRA, the UDA, the British Army, the intelligence services. Let's get it all out in the open, and everybody will then get a clean, you know, as long as you tell us the truth, we're not going to punish you any further.
Well, I mean, you're characterising this as coming from people like the Daily Mail, but looking at the Daily Mail, one of their headlines is the whitewash of killings in the Northern Ireland Troubles will not bring reconciliation. I wonder whether this isn't really much more a push by the Ministry of Defence.
Well, let me put it, all right, let me just finish what I was going to say. In actual fact, when the Tories went to Northern Ireland and said, well, why don't we just pass a bill that says everybody's exonerated, nobody on any side was willing to accept that. That's why it wasn't in the original Good Friday Agreement. If it was agreed that everybody was going to be, it was all going to be forgotten about, then that could have been in the original, but nobody wanted that. There's various reasons why they didn't want it. On the loyalist side, they wanted to see, Republicans who'd been involved in violence punished. And on the Republican side, they wanted to see the British Army's role in running the loyalist paramilitary campaign exposed. But the Good Friday Agreement put all that on one side.
Let's just put that on one side and move forward on what we can agree on. It's easy to characterise this as being led by the Daily Mail, but quite clearly the Daily Mail is saying that this is a whitewash of the killings in Northern Ireland at the moment anyway. So let's have a listen anyway now to, this is a clip on the Troubles Bill itself. And apparently, I mean, this is another Al Jazeera one. I'm using quite a few from Al Jazeera this week. Quite good, I think. Coverage they're giving. Al Jazeera grants accused murderers conditional immunity.
He was almost certainly killed by the British Army, and the government are just going to say, sorry, here's your circumstances, and they'll basically get a report saying that he was walking through the Royal between two women and he got one bullet was fired through his heart. We need more than that.
Does it close down potential criminal investigations, it closes down inquests, it closes down
anyone who wanted to take a civil action against the state or any individual for that matter either by any other name. It's an amnesty for murder and torture and mayhem, basically. What it will do will allow other less democratic countries around the world to say, well, if Britain can get away with this, why can't we? This is such draconian legislation that people will ask the question, what is there to hide?
I am constantly asked over a long period of time, do you want justice or do you want truth or recovery? Can you imagine if your relative was murdered in any circumstance and the police come round and they go, would you like us to investigate this or you just want us to tell you what happened? The answer is, we want it all.
So that's Al Jazeera report there. I think before we hear from Martin, I'd like to contrast this with last week's report from Channel 4 News about Sri Lanka. So I've got another clip, which is actually from the Dispatches documentary, which aired last Tuesday, which details some of the collusion that was going on in Sri Lanka between the secret services there and the terrorists. So let's have a listen now to a little clip going right across the world from Belfast to what's the capital of Sri Lanka? Martin?
Colombo.
Colombo, thank you. From Belfast to Colombo, and have a listen to a clip from the Sri Lanka 2019 Easter Church Bombs documentary, which came out last week.
This was the moment he introduced one of Sri Lanka's most senior intelligence officers to the head of a known terror group. Maulana told UN investigators the meeting lasted 3 hours and that he was told to wait outside.
The meeting went a long time. The meeting finished and Suresala told me, Rajapaksa meet an unsafe situation in Sri Lanka. That's only the way to Kotabai become president. So this is the meeting between them. So the terrorist group and Suresh Saleh.
Suresh Saleh told this program that he was in Malaysia at the time of the alleged meeting. By the end of 2018, Zahran's group, the NTJ, was beginning to make headlines.
The bodies of two police officers who were on duty at a roadblock in Batiklo have been found under suspicious circumstances.
The NTJ killed two policemen but managed to escape. Then, by January 2019, police investigations led them to a safe house on a coconut farm. Maulana says it was the same place where Suresh Saleh met with Zahran and the NTJ. When detectives raided the property, they made an alarming discovery. Alongside this huge stash of explosives, police also found weapons and military hardware. They arrested two suspects. They had enough information to arrest Zahran and his NTJ followers. But at every turn, police investigators ran into brick walls. Our whistleblower can confirm that while police tried to track down the leader of the terrorist group, military intelligence was producing evidence which police investigations would later reveal to be baseless. These conflicting and unfounded intelligence reports, seen here, show that Sri Lanka's military intelligence tried to stifle the investigation at every turn.
So I think you can see what I'm saying here, Martin. What we've got here is a similar sort of a situation going on in Belfast and Colombo, where the secret services, military intelligence, are actually colluding with terrorists for political ends.
Well, that's right. I mean, obviously, it's coming back to the troubles in Northern Ireland and this bill. Nobody on any side of the political spectrum in Northern Ireland wants to see this bill go through. Most of the interviewees in the Al Jazeera clip that you made earlier were probably from the Republican side listening to what they were saying, and they don't want, because what it will do is it means that there will never be any investigation of the collusion between the loyalist paramilitaries and the Force Research Unit, Brigadier Gordon Kerr and all of that. And the loyalists, on that, for their part, they don't want to see a situation where ex-IRA people who are still wanted are let off. And in actual fact, there's a consensus about both communities that they don't want this bill. So I think it's pretty perverse of the British or the English government, effectively, to force it on them. And we will see what happens when it gets to the floor of the House of Commons.
So what do you think will happen? And I think it's also useful to, to get your take on exactly what you think was going on that is so important to cover up. Surely the justice system, has to be open to anybody. You know, they're saying now, for example, that even if you personally have got evidence that one of your relatives or loved ones was murdered by somebody associated with the security services, that you won't be able to bring that case to court. This is pretty damn serious, isn't it?
Well, that's why on the Republican side, they don't want this bill, and the loyalists don't want it for equal but opposite reasons. I think the politics of this are going to be interesting, because it may well be that the Tories will whip their own people to vote for it, and then the question will be what the opposition parties are going to do. I think it's very unwise to push through a bill which nobody in Northern Ireland wants. The situation as it stands at the moment is not satisfactory to anybody. Everybody understands that, but the situation is such that those who've been released from prison under the Good Friday Agreement, they've been released. They haven't been exonerated. They've just been released. And, as part of the deal, and that includes loyalist paramilitary prisoners and Republicans. But nobody is saying that any crime that's been committed in the past is just going to be ignored. There is another possibility, which is you could have a proper Truth and Reconciliation Commission where everybody agrees that we're going to talk it all through, find out what happened, and everybody will be let off, which is effectively what happened in South Africa. But it's not really on in Northern Ireland. It never has been. Nobody on either side is willing to accept it. And I think it's very unwise of the British government to bring this forward when there's such hostility to it on the ground in Northern Ireland. It doesn't seem to make any sense to me.
Surely it's got something to do with the fact that the Tories have got a whacking majority still.
Well, that's true, and they could perhaps force it through, but they would be doing that in the face of the Democratic Unionist Party, for example, are opposed to this bill. So they'd have to ram it down their throats as well. I mean, my advice would be to just leave well alone. Everybody knows that the situation as it stands is not entirely satisfactory, and that, justice hasn't really been done on any side, but everybody's agreed to put that on one side and move on. What this does is actually brings it all up again without resolving it.
Yeah, but if you leave it well alone, maybe some of the key people who were involved in collusion, people working for the British Army in Northern Ireland who were actually organising terrorism, might have to go to jail.
Well, that's why they're bringing it forward, Tony. Because ultimately, of course, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who's investigated several times by the British police force, including John Stalker, he was basically commissioning murder via the UDA. And I speak as you call me Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. That would be the Republican point of view. They do not want exoneration because they think they've been pushing for an international inquiry into collusion between the British Army and the Loyalist paramilitaries, and they don't want a British inquiry. They want an international inquiry. And, of course, the implication of that is that Brigadier Gordon Kerr, who is still alive, should go to prison for 25 years, just like any other IRA volunteer had to do. But, of course, the British establishment don't want to do that. They're not going to do that either. They're definitely not going to prosecute him because there were various attempts to prosecute him in the past, and it was all kept into the long grass.
This is yet another death knell for British justice, as if we needed another one. And also, of course, it's more evidence that we are living in a kind of mafia state where if you're in the clique, you'll be protected.
Well, that's true, but nobody in Northern Ireland is particularly surprised by that. That's what the war was all about, was that the state was not acceptable to a large proportion of the population. And that's still true, although it's changed to some extent. We'll have to see what happens with this. I think even if it passes, it'll go to the Lords, and the Lords will knock it back because they realise that people in Northern Ireland don't want it. And that's across the board. It isn't controversial in Northern Ireland. Nobody wants it.
Let's hope then that some of these trials do proceed and that some of these collusion criminals do go to jail.
And of course, from the Loyalist point of view, they want to see ex-IRA people sent to prison, etc., etc. Now, that's probably, the police in Northern Ireland have got a difficult row to hoe there. They are investigating historic crimes, but on the other hand, if they start busting one lot of people, they've got to start busting everybody.
Yeah, I mean,
that's going to be difficult to run.
fascinating parallels between the sort of battle between honest cops and the secret services. Exactly the same sort of thing going on over in Sri Lanka. Incredible, really. Anyway, just before we go to our guests, we've got a story from the Times, which is behind the scenes. I thought this was a fascinating little story because what it says about the guy, Michael Fawcett, who was working for King Charles, being forced out. It says, behind the scenes, it's the Queen who is running the show, which is quite a testy headline. As the publication revealed last September, it was Camilla who insisted on the appointment of former newspaper executive Tobin Andreas as the King's new spokesman, press spokesman, that is, a move that apparently even blindsided Sir Clive Alderton, the monarch's long-serving private secretary. As one royal insider explained at the time, I think there is a sense that behind the scenes, it's largely the Queen who is running the show. She makes a lot more decisions than people think, especially with Michael Fawcett out of the picture. Well, maybe one of the reasons that Fawcett is out of the picture is because Camilla has got some good contacts, who knows, maybe in military intelligence, that have managed to force him out in order to make it impossible for Charles to employ him in the jobs. The department of Mr. Fawcett in departure, sorry, of Mr. Fawcett in November 2021 devastated the King, who was said to be so reliant on his former valet that he once declared, "I can manage without just about anyone except for Michael." But his absence from the royal court only appears to have strengthened Camilla's position. King does have weaknesses, and it's fair to say that the Queen knows how to exploit them, added an insider. But it's a bigger court now, and the King has duties that can't be ignored that need the support of the Queen. I find it quite amusing that Camilla, the name is so similar to Carmilla, which was the big famous vampire novel just before the Dracula books came out. But the point here, Martin, is quite important, isn't it? Who is really running the show? Is Camilla really sort of a bit of decoration in the background? Because the thing is, the institution of the monarchy in Britain has become much more politicised. And I would point to, you know, the fact that when Joe Biden visited, he went to Windsor Castle rather than to visit the politicians in Whitehall or Downing Street or whatever. It's at Windsor where many of these events are taking place, where presidential visits are meeting with heads of big corporations at Windsor Castle these days.
Well, I mean, in a sense, the institution has always been politicised. It's not, you know, the idea that it stands above politics is a bit of a myth, isn't it? Let's face it. And of course, you know, if Camilla is, you know, flexing her muscles, that's totally consistent with the whole history of the British monarchy going back hundreds of years. You know, I mean, there's always been infighting within the royal family. It's not, there's nothing new there, is there really?
No, and Tobin, T-O-B-Y-N, Andrei, A-N-D-R-E-A-E, I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that, but this role of the press secretary is actually a very important role, isn't it, the King's press secretary?
Well, it's important to him and important to the institution. And if they're behind the scenes of people's backstabbing going on, well, that's not necessarily good for the institution, is it? But it's very opaque to the outsider to know exactly who's in, who's out, and what the game's about.
Also worth mentioning, this is from the Town and Country magazine. Who is Alice Keppel? That is to say, that is Camilla's ancestor, was mistress to King Edward VII. So, you know, it's interesting the way that the women have played a role in this case with Edward VII and with King Charles. The Camilla's family have been sort of hanging around in the background as mistresses. The only thing is, with Diana's actions, she forced the issue and she wasn't going to allow that to continue. And so this time it's absolutely come out in the open. But anyway, I think it's interesting looking at these power plays going on at the very, very top of our society. And in a way, it's contrasted. I mean, actually, Camilla's base is in Wiltshire, not very far from us. But it contrasts with what we're going to be hearing from our guests now. And we've got I don't know if you can introduce yourself, Wesley, and say a little bit about Acorn and maybe introduce your friend you've brought along too.
Yeah, I can do that. Thanks for having us on, firstly. So yeah, we're ACORN. We're a community union. So that might sound quite different to some of you, but much like a workers' union who fight for workers' rights, we fight for the community's rights, and we help with evictions and kind of make sure that the powers that be don't exert their will over people like you and I. And I'm here with Apasra today as well. She's one of the committee members for ACORN as well.
Yeah, my name's Apasra. Yeah, thanks for having us. I'm currently the membership officer on the committee for the Bristol branch of ACORN.
So can you just tell us, both of you, one by one, why it is that you joined ACORN? What do you think is the what floats your boat about this organisation?
Okay, so I remember one of the organisers in ACORN, when I used to hang out on Facebook quite a lot, once just sent me a friend request. I responded, and ever since I saw him post lots of stuff about ACORN and what they were up to. I saw him post lots of footage from eviction resistances when bailiffs come along to evict a member of our union, and their fellow members come along to basically be a barrier, be a wedge between them and the bailiff, to repel the bailiffs and get them to the negotiating table to fight for a better deal for the members. I saw a lot of that. I thought it was amazing that people were doing this within their own community, and ever since I've just been interested in the kind of work that they've done. What ACORN does is speaking to members of the community. It is understood by working class people all over the country that the system doesn't really work for us. Politicians do not listen to working class people and what their needs are. Working class people are sick of cuts, they are sick of austerity, and ACORN does the job of uniting working class people, regardless of their ethnicity, their religion, their culture, their nationality, to fight for a better world and for better conditions within our communities and within our lives.
Well, I think it's social justice. That's what we want. Let's have a bit of social justice, please. The idea that the super rich don't pay any tax, whilst what's happening here in Bristol is pretty shocking. The people with no money are going to be forced to pay tax while the super rich don't pay any. So let's have a listen now to this is a clip from ITV News, where Wesley, who's joining us in the studio, it's going to be maybe a bit weird for you, Wesley, hearing yourself talking.
But anyway, this is now.
Wesley earlier, in fact, I think it was last week on ITV News, giving an account of, this whole business of the possible ending of council tax relief here in Bristol, which might mean that people with no money are going to be forced to pay council tax. So here's Wesley Bear talking on ITV.
Every penny counts for Wesley Bear. The benefits he receives means he needs to contribute only £20 a month in council tax on his one-bed flat.
That reduction helps a lot, and I think if I was to lose that, that's probably like £120 that I'd have to pay out, which I don't have. If this scheme was to go, I would have to think about what I'm not going to pay in order to pay this, which could put me in a world of trouble.
The City Council is consulting on if or how to continue its council tax reduction scheme, which currently provides 23,000 working-age households with up to 100% support. This afternoon, Wesley joined others in opposing any changes to the scheme, protesting both outside and inside City Hall, where emotions ran high.
What about the families? What about people with children who are working minimum hours and can't do washing? Can't put food on their children's table.
The council have said that they are doing a consultation, so they haven't made any decisions. However, when you look at the consultation, it's very clear what they want to happen. They've said, we need to save this £3 million, and they've given you how much each option will save. The only option that will save that, according to them, is to scrap it entirely.
Similar changes were proposed and defeated in 2017. Now, some say being forced to pay more than £1,500 a year would lose them the roof over their head.
Children are growing up in poverty, and this will not do any good. This will make everything worse for them. There is nothing positive to do besides, you know, supposedly raise revenue for the council.
Tonight, the council said its support had amounted to £325 million since 2016. But it faced even more difficult decisions after more than a decade of national austerity. 10 options are out to consultation, which close on September the 25th. For people like Wesley, though, there is only one option, to leave the current system alone. Richard Payne, ITV News, Bristol.
That was on ITVF last week, actually. Now, in front of me, I've got this thing which came through the door, Council Tax Reduction Scheme Scenarios. Now, it doesn't actually say on it that it's a consultation until you get right inside. It's the most fiendishly complicated document. In fact, you get two through the post, which is supposed to be part of this consultation. One of them just says scenarios, and then the other one says 2024-2025. Lots and lots of pictures of people sort of walking around holding hands, one in a wheelchair, but there's really no proper explanation as to how this is supposed to work. So you're given these scenarios: John, Jasmine, Hanny, James and Jeffrey's finances, and then you're given a list of options: option 1, 2A, 2B, 2C, 3A, 3B, 3C. It's incredibly fiendishly complicated consultation. Anyway, Wesley, what do you? I mean, I look at this and I think, well, most people will scratch their heads, look at this, and throw it in the bin.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think most people are going to do that. I think quite a major point as well to bring up is that consultation is only actually in English as well. There's no other copies of the consultation in any other languages, which kind of, when you consider the diversity of Bristol, that's quite a significant point, I think. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you. It's a really difficult form to understand, let alone to kind of go through. And I'm not really sure why they gave us 10 options, because, you know, option one is to keep it as it is, and the other 9 options are to completely stitch up Bristolians. So, I don't know. I don't really know what the council are thinking with this one, save money.
Surely, I mean, we are saying to stitch us up. That the idea really is that we discussed this last week, was that since 2014, there's been massive cutbacks from central government and the amount of money that's coming from central taxation to help fund local government. So literally, the accountants and the politicians at City Hall here are saying, well, you know, we're paying all this massive amount of money out to help people with their council tax. Maybe, you know, we just can't afford to continue doing that.
Yeah, maybe. I would probably strongly suggest, though, that if the coffers are empty, that could be down to things like the Bristol Beacon project, where our lovely mayor wasted £131 million of taxpayers' money, which is ludicrous, if you ask me. And I mean, I could sit here and reel off so much money that that the government, I guess, or the local council here have wasted in Bristol, that I think is ludicrous to attempt to save, they say, £3 million from taxpayers when the estimated costs of said savings are going to be almost £3 million anyway. So, I mean, I think the council have already made their decisions. They've already budgeted for this council tax reduction changing. So, I mean, yeah, they will say that. I'm not sure that we at Acorn believe that it's quite that bad when we consider how much has been spent and wasted elsewhere, as I said just now.
Well, that's very helpful that you've explained to me that all I need to do is just tick the box marked option one.
Option one, indeed. I would highly suggest everybody tick option one.
Because it doesn't make it clear at all that will keep the present scheme. It's management speak, completely confounding. Anyway, look, Martin Summers, maybe you can explain a bit about this whole council tax, because it just seems to me perverse that you've got to have a council tax reduction scheme, because the council tax actually includes all the people with no money that they're being told that they have to pay tax. And the old system before the community charge back in the 1990s with Thatcher, and it basically they had the rates where the taxes were charged on people who did have money, i.e. the people that owned property. That all changed, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, in the early 1980s, the Thatcher government decided, she visited somebody in Streatham, And they were telling her that they had quite posh houses in Streatham, that they were paying huge amounts of money in rates to pay for youth clubs in Brixton. And her view was that was completely wrong, that if people in Brixton wanted youth clubs, they should have to pay for them themselves. Why should wealthy people on Streatham Hill have to pay for youth clubs in Brixton? So she came up with the wizard wheeze, well, let's get rid of the rates. Now, the rating system had been imposed originally by Elizabeth I, hundreds of years previously, and it was a system whereby the property owners in each community had to pay in to a fund, which was then used to help the poor in that community. And it was bitterly resented at the time and has been resented ever since, because effectively it's a progressive tax on property. Individuals aren't charged, it's actually on properties. And the bigger your property was, the more money you had to pay in the rates. And of course, it's always caused gnashing of teeth amongst the well-heeled. But she just thought, well, we can just get rid of it. You know, it's time to get rid of this, and we'll move to a different system where everybody's going to be charged, and we're all going to be charged the same amount at the beginning. That was the idea, the so-called poll tax. It's called the community charge, but everybody was going to pay the same amount. So if you were living in a posh house on Streatham Hill, you would pay the same amount as somebody living in a council flat in Brixton. And of course, this was ridiculous, because many people in the council flat in Brixton hadn't paid anything before, and then you're suddenly going to present them with a £1,000 bill. And of course, there was a big uprising against it. They opposed it, first of all, in Scotland, because they thought the resistance there was going to be most fierce, which it was. But they imposed it a year before they imposed it in England, because they thought if you can break the Scots, then the English will just fall into line. What it led to was the rise of the SNP, actually, in Scotland. And of course, they never dared to impose it in Northern Ireland. In Northern Ireland, they still have the good old-fashioned rates from the reign of Elizabeth I. The reason being that the collection of, if you don't pay council tax, because community charge, council tax was brought in after the collapse of Thatcher, but it's still based on taxing individuals rather than property. In Northern Ireland, you still tax property. And the reason they didn't bring it in Northern Ireland is because when the bailiffs go down the Falls or the Shankill Road to take away people's tellies, they're going to end up dead. And in any case, there's already a war going on, and it was considered far too dangerous to even attempt. And it wasn't attempted, and therefore, Northern Ireland still has the old-fashioned rating system. Scotland, because they were forced down the line, and then England down the line. And it's just a poor tax. It's very difficult to collect. I used to work at Bristol Desk Advice Centre as a researcher, and one of the problems with it is you're chasing lots of people who haven't got any money for trivial amounts of money. So in actual fact, you're wasting a lot of money. You probably spend more money chasing after the £200 you're owed than you're going to get from them when you've got it off them. It's just ridiculous. More straightforward to tax property, because property can't go. If you don't pay the rates, they just come around and impound the building. That's it.
Apastra or Wesley, maybe you could answer this one. I mean, what happens? Because if you can't pay and you don't have the money, I think, in fact, Martin, there was a campaign, I remember, in the early 1990s of people simply not paying the community charge, or the poll tax, as they called it then. Are people going to go to prison for not paying this tax?
Well, I mean, I don't know, is the honest answer. I mean, we all know that you can go to prison for not paying this council tax, as it were. I mean, I don't know what people are going to do. I can speak for myself, and I don't think that I am going to be able to pay this tax if the council tax reduction scheme stops. So therefore, I'm not going to be paying it, and I'm going to have to kind of tackle what happens after that. But I'm kind of the opinion, I refuse to put myself and make my life any less in order to line the pockets of the council, you know. So it's not something that I'm going to be able to keep up with, and I'm still relatively young, fit and healthy, and able to go out, you know. It's scary to think of some of the families and some of the people out there who can't physically go out and earn more, and how they're going to pay it. It's going to be difficult for some people. It's going to be real difficult.
But I mean, the thing is, we're living in a Labour city. We're living in a city where people have voted against this whole sort of conservative Tory rule by the wealthy to defend the poor. And yet it seems to me as if that now the financial guns are being pointed at the poorest in the city.
Yeah, that's absolutely how it feels to us at Acorn. Like, we, you know, we believe that Marvin Rees and this local government have started a war on the poor of Bristol. That's totally what it is. You know, they've, like you said, they've pointed both barrels at us, and they're letting off as and when they want. And it's a scary thought. It's a scary thing to be happening.
So, Apasra, what do you think Acorn might be able to achieve here if they do impose this tax on people with no money?
Well, currently in our community union, we're going through a process where we are looking and assessing different kind of campaigns. This current campaign aimed at keeping the council tax reduction scheme at the moment has gained so much traction because we know that it touches so many of our members. The key is just to keep organising and to keep fighting. Back in 2017, the Bristol branch of Acorn led a campaign in order to keep this benefit, this vital benefit for so many low-income families in the city. It's been achieved back in 2017. We believe with the right amount of action and pressure, we can do it again. And that's what we hope to achieve, simply.
Well, I'm sure you will.
if I could just add to that, I think just to kind of let anybody know who's listening, let's say worst case scenario comes and the council tax reduction scheme is kind of scrapped and people have to find the extra money. Us at Acorn, we will absolutely defend the citizens and the communities of Bristol as far as we can. So although we're not a resource in terms of we have nothing to hand out, but we absolutely have no intention of allowing anybody to be kicked out of their homes or anything like that. So I would suggest if anybody finds any difficulty, if the worst happens, to please get in touch with Acorn, and we will do absolutely anything we can.
What we say at Acorn, member defence and being there, standing up to the bailiffs, is the bread and butter of our community union, is what Acorn is known for, and it is just what Acorn does, very simply.
Okay, I mean, I'd like to wind up with a couple of takes on Acorn. Can you just give us an idea of you know, the way that Acorn, either of you, has interacted with the city council? Because I seem to remember that there was some sort of attempt, anyway, for the mayor to set up a housing think tank policy group which didn't include Acorn. Now, Acorn is actually a member-led organisation which has hundreds of members in the city, and yet the council decided that Acorn shouldn't be part of that for some reason, and the mayor just appointed some of his friends instead.
Yeah, I think Apasra is probably best to answer this. She knows about this scenario very well.
I wasn't really a member of Acorn when it happened. I believe there was something that it began with, something called the Renters Summit, which is basically the idea of transforming Bristol into a living rent city where it is easy to afford rent. There was something called the Living Rent Commission, which was set up, which hosted, some tenants in the city, some social policy experts, like social scientists, I suppose. And, of course, some landlords from landlord associations. And despite the input that Acorn had previously in, you know, something like this actually coming about, Acorn was shunned completely. So that was last year, back in the summer. We gathered as members of our union, and for the first ever meeting set up by this commission, we managed to just kick up a fuss and bring the meeting to a halt to say, you know, we deserve a seat or 10 at the table because, after all, we are the biggest community union in the city, possibly in the country, although I'm not sure about that, but certainly we are a very big voice in Bristol City and are therefore entitled to share our input in the commission. But unfortunately, we were brushed under the carpet, never to be spoken of again by them. although there was some other issues as well. But we did try and kick up a fuss that very day.
Yeah, it does seem like that the Labour mayor, Marvin Rees, and the city office seem to represent landlords much more, in fact also of course property speculators, far more than they do ordinary people around the city. It almost seems like that's their main interest is the the wealthy landlords and the wealthy property speculators getting their planning permission seems to be their top priority rather than ordinary people. But look, the last thing I wanted to ask about Acorn is, look, what about where, say, for example, one of your members is being evicted, has been through the courts, the landlord has got a possession order, they've decided they want to increase the rent, say, and the previous tenant doesn't really want to pay that extra rent, and so they've gone, or maybe they've got into arrears or whatever. Can you just give us an example or a couple of examples of what you're actually able to do in that circumstance? Because you would have thought that if a court decision has been made, then that's it.
Obviously, a court's decision is it. But we at Acorn don't believe that a roof over your head should be a luxury item. So in the first instance, in a scenario like that, we would absolutely stop the bailiffs from coming in. We only ever engage in a peaceful rebellion, I guess. We link arms and stand in the way. But in terms of, I guess, aftercare is what you're asking. I mean, yesterday, for example, last week we stopped an eviction of a gentleman called Steve in Clifton. And last week we actually sat down with his landlords and had a negotiation, and we successfully negotiated a repayment plan for him. We actually got his court fees reduced by 50% also just by negotiating with the landlords. So we're pretty hands-on from the moment we're informed by our member that they're going to be evicted. Like I said, the first point is to stop the eviction, and ultimately that's the main thing we do. But anything we can do within kind of the realms of what we're able to do, we will do. I mean, we can't give legal advice and stuff like that because we're not legally trained. But when it comes to first-hand action and, direct action with landlords and stopping bailiffs, it's kind of what we mainly do.
And whereabouts can listeners find you? What's the easiest way to connect up on social media or whatever?
Yeah, and Facebook is a really good way to get involved with us. You can go to Acorn the Union website as well, which will give you kind of a comprehensive list of our contact details and stuff. A passer will probably be the one that gets back in touch with the guys who contact me, and the membership officer. But yeah, you can get us on social media. That is soon going to be even further reaching. We're kind of looking to branch out into some more social medias. So at the moment, it's just Facebook and our own website.
Well, look, both of you, really appreciate you coming in. Thanks very much. But before you go, I'd like to get your take on what's going on in the United States, because it's quite similar over there. And Robert Kennedy, who is standing for the Democratic nomination this week, has been talking about housing over in the United States. So RFK, he's also known as, he's talking on the Bobby and Cheryl it's the Tim Dillon Show, edition number 360 this week. I thought he had some very interesting things to say about housing and what's happening in the US. And I think we need to kind of keep an eye on what's, even though it's obviously thousands of, what is it, about 4,000 miles away or something, what happens often is in the United States then happens over here. We've been seeing this increasingly, even the idea of having a mayor, for example, what some would say a nightmare. this has come over from the United States and been kind of imposed here in Bristol, even though hopefully next May it's all being reversed. So let's have a listen now to the hopeful presidential candidate for the Democratic Party, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., talking about housing over in the United States on the Tim Dillon Show.
I think housing is a critical issue, and it's not just critical for people in San Francisco. Our kids, I have Cheryl and I have seven kids between 20 and 39. And when I was that age, I was already thinking of, buying a house, or how am I going to do it, et cetera. Where do I want to live? And I don't know any of my kids' friends who are even thinking that. A lot of them are living with their parents. And, you know, the chance of them actually buying a house is, unless they do incredibly well with their lives, is very, very slim. And my kids are, you know, they have good jobs, they make money, but it's not enough to buy a house. And 2 years ago, the average price of a house was $215,000, and even that was out of reach for a lot of
kids. In America, that was the average?
That was the average across the country.
Okay.
On the coast, it's much higher. This is the average. Today, it's $400,000. It's 2 years ago. And you're now paying, you know, you were back then, you're paying maybe 3% interest. Now you're paying 7% interest. The house is 3 or 4 or 5 times expensive, and there's no way any. And then everybody has this experience of knowing somebody who is about to buy a house, and then somebody comes in just before they go into escrow. Somebody comes in with a cash offer and snatches it out from under them. And this is just now a ubiquitous experience. And what's happening is not only are we, you know, suffering inflation from the constant wars, $8 trillion on war. $8 trillion that we didn't have on regime change wars since 2002. We're also, but you have these three giant companies, BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, who all own each other. You know, BlackRock has $10 trillion under management.
These are all private equity companies?
Yeah, they're the biggest companies in the world. And they own 88% of the S&P 500, those three companies. They own 88% of the S&P 500. So they already own everything. And now they've decided they're going to buy every single family home in America. So, they're on track now to own the corporate control of 60% of the single family homes in America within 6 years. Right, that if you follow the breadcrumbs,
it'll go back to BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street.
Larry Fink, who is the CEO of BlackRock, is also on the board of the World Economic Forum.
Yes,
which, you know, their mantra is we're going to have this great reset. What does that mean? It means that, and these are their quotes, not mine. You will own nothing, and you will be happy.
You'll be happy.
You know what I would do immediately, there's a lot of things you can do. One is you can change the tax code to make it unprofitable, because our kids are now competing against BlackRock. So BlackRock has a bottomless bank book. It has the lowest interest rates on the planet of anybody. And our kids now have to compete against that company.
Now, why is their rates so? Are they lending themselves money? How does it work?
Well, first of all, they own all the banks. They own all the credit card companies. Right. And they,
that helps.
They,
yeah.
Just because they have a huge bank book, they're a safe loan. So there's zero risk in loaning to BlackRock.
Right.
And so the banks will give them the lowest possible rates. And our kids then have to compete. You know, our kids who have no credit rating, who have, you know, a 600 credit rate or whatever it is, are paying not 7%, but maybe 10% interest.
Right.
And they're competing against somebody that's getting 3% interest. It's not right. And, you know, we have American dream in this country. The promise as World War II, your parents' generation, my parents' generation, if you worked hard, if you played by the rules, you could have one job, not three. And you could own a house, you could take a summer vacation, you could raise a family, and you could put away money for retirement. That is just not even for anybody. That is not
it's
true.
It's over now.
That's over. These kids are not going to own homes. And if you don't own a home, you don't care about your community. You don't care about the schools. You don't care. You know,
you're less vested.
You're less vested. And so, You're not doing the things that homeowners do to take care of the, to invest in their community, to make it a better
right.
place to live. So, and you also have no access to capital because, you know, if you are a homeowner and you want to start a small business and you want to take a risk, you get a second mortgage on your home and you have some access to capital because you have an asset. You can go to the bank with and say, look, I know this may be stupid, but I'm going to start a restaurant and I'm going to put up my home as collateral, and I'm going to do it. So, but if you don't have a home, you have no access to capital.
That's a great point.
Somebody else,
no way to tap the equity in your home. You know, you're cut off from that source of money. You're also, I think, people that are not homeowners are subject to the rising rents.
Yeah.
All the time.
You don't have any control over it.
You have no control.
And the ownership by these companies is driving up the cost of rents. 48% of the people in this country who are renting have anxiety. And Cheryl and I talk about this all the time. Yeah. You're living paycheck to paycheck in this country, you know, and 57% of Americans cannot put their hands on $1,000 if they have emergency.
Right.
If you're living paycheck to paycheck, you are not that. Fewer than half of those people are making enough money to pay for basic human needs for food, transportation, and housing.
Oh, okay. So before we hear from Apasra and Wesley, Martin, what do you make of that over in the States? Because it's not just happening there. One of the articles in Yahoo Finance, Lloyds Banking Group plans to become one of the UK's biggest landlords. It targets to buy 50,000 homes by 2030. The move comes in conjunction with the bank's recently launched Citra Living brand that pushes it into private home rental market as low interest rates take hold. Well, that's a little old, isn't it? But anyway, it's as interest rates take off, Lloyds has looked into diversity. It's offering away from traditional lending. A Lloyds spokesperson, who is unnamed, says, as highlighted at the launch, Citra Living will initially start small with a focus on buying and renting properties. This will be achieved by working alongside leading house builders to address the increasing demand for rental properties. The aim is to gradually provide incremental stock to the UK rental market over coming years. Well, so this is a big move away from people owning their own homes. And of course, we've got also increasing interest rates, which are meaning that many people who are on mortgages simply can't afford and may be going to Lloyds and saying, please, you know, you buy my house off me and I'll pay you rent instead. So the whole housing market seems to be broken. And what Acorn is doing is kind of at the sharp end of all of that, Martin.
Well, in the US, after the 2008 banking collapse, which was brought out by, you know, the trigger for it. It wasn't the real cause, but the trigger was loans to low-income people to buy their own homes, which, you know, what they call liar loans, no-income, no-job loans, ninja loans. And, of course, what should have happened when Obama took over, those people should have been kept in their properties and the banks should have taken the hit for making the loans. It's their responsibility. The reason they couldn't pay is because they were given the money by the bank, and the bank should have known that they couldn't pay. But they, because what happens in the US, of course, is if you decide you can't pay, you can just put the keys through the door and walk away, and you don't even take a debt with you. Whereas in Britain, of course, that debt follows you. So there's a bit of a difference in the legal structure. But you're now moving to a situation where big corporations are now buying up rent properties, which become available, and then renting them out. So everybody will become basically tenants of big corporations. Now, of course, the answer to this in Britain in the 1940s was the creation of council housing, which, of course, has now been decimated. But, of course, housing is fundamental in any society, you know, especially in the US, when some states it gets very, very cold. Homeless people have to sleep in the sewers and railway stations because they can't sleep in the streets.
So, Apasra, Wesley, what do you make of the situation in the States? It looks as if things are only going to... I mean, even the idea of dealing with a buy-to-let landlord seems to be slowly sliding away, as interest rates mean that it can often be no longer profitable for them to carry on renting out a house, and someone like Lloyds is going to come and snap it off them.
Yeah, I mean, I think is ridiculous, if I'm honest. Just kind of touch back on something I said earlier about Acorn. It's not just Acorn, it's myself too, but, you know, I don't think a home should be a luxury item, you know, and the fact that people are going to be almost held to ransom, you know, and going to be forced to pay increased rents, and, you know, it's ridiculous. I mean, it's difficult to know what to do, difficult to know what to say, but yeah, I just think so many people at the moment are kind of living paycheck to paycheck and so close to being homeless that it's just becoming a madness, you know? It really is.
Yeah, I mean, these are basic human rights, aren't they? The right to shelter, the right to water, the right to food, the right to a job. It seems that they're being taken away one by one.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we have it quite easy in this country with some other things, but like you say, you know, these are basic human rights and these are not luxury items. You know, I can't emphasize that enough. You know, it shouldn't be something that we have to think about neglecting other parts of our lives in order to keep a roof over our head. It's not a worry that we should have in a civilized world, if you ask me. So yeah, it's difficult out here for a lot of people, and like with the council tax reduction obviously here, it's gonna get a lot more difficult in this city. So it's atrocious, really. It's the only word for it.
Have you got any predictions on what's going to happen with the council tax reduction scheme?
Predictions? Yeah, I predict that Acorn are going to put masses and masses amount of pressure on the local government, and we are going to get them to keep it the same.
Well, that's good to hear. Anyway, look, both yourself and Apasra, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
And we may even hear from Joe Banks, who's also joined us in the studio there. But in the meantime, let's hear another clip from Robert Kennedy, because before the break, we're going to have a little listen to the election fixing that's going on in the United States. The DNC is the Democratic National Committee, and they are trying everything they can to stop Robert F. Kennedy Jr. standing for the presidential nomination for the Democratic Party. Anyway, he's got some interesting info on how they're trying to do that, how they're trying to make sure that even he cannot stand to be president.
The DNC does not want me in the primary. They, you know, they have the candidate that they want, who is President Biden. They don't want him to debate. They don't want him to do retail politics. They don't want him to have unscripted conversations with voters. And they definitely don't want him to debate me. And so they look at me, I think, I feel, as although I haven't spoken to them directly, I've written them but have not gotten reply, as a colossal nuisance, and they're doing everything they can to fix the results. So one of the things they've done is they've made it so that any vote that I get in Iowa or New Hampshire will count for Biden, and they're trying to do the same thing now in Georgia.
Are they doing that?
Well, they're passing a rule that any candidate who steps into the state of New Hampshire or Iowa to campaign will lose all their delegates. And so I've campaigned in both states, so I lose their delegates. But now what they're trying to do is we're going to know on September 14th whether they actually do it, is they're trying to pass another rule that if you step foot in New Hampshire or Iowa, that any vote you get in Georgia, which is a big, big delegate state, will also count for the president and not for, you know, so they're basically disenfranchising everybody in those states. So there's no campaign. And they're talking about this idea of making myself and Marianne Williamson, who's the other Democratic candidate, to pay for all the primaries ourselves.
So there you go. Election fixing, not by the Russians this time, Martin, is it?
No, but I mean, this situation in the US is because the US political system has been rigged for many years. It's still rigged. It's very difficult to get anywhere in it. It's a first-past-the-post system with even further refinements of control from the top to prevent anybody coming through that hasn't been pre-chosen by the oligarchy, basically. And this is the United States as it has evolved. The primaries only came in the 1960s. Before that, the party bosses just chose who they wanted to be the candidates. The primaries were supposed to make the system more open, so therefore you get people you then have to register either as a Democrat or as a Republican or as an independent. So in other words, the system tells you what parties there are. In the rest of the world, people are allowed to set up political parties and compete. In the US, you have to register in one of the two official parties, which effectively means there's one party. And those two, and then, of course, within those parties, they then have...
They've got a Green Party in the States, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. But every time they stand, all they do is take votes from the Democrats and let the Republicans win. So Cornel Wilde is going to stand for the Green Party in the US. And all that will do is filter off votes from the left, which means that the Republicans, well, whoever they are, will win.
To the UK.
Well, it is like the UK, but it's worse than the UK because the internal democracy within the two parties is fixed. The Democratic National Committee, which decides ultimately what goes on, they have what they call superdelegates, which are appointed by the party hierarchy, which can overrule whoever you vote for. And Bernie Sanders was stitched up completely by this, and Robert F. Kennedy will be stitched up as well. Exactly. The problem for the mainstream Democrats is that Biden is possibly unelectable because he may just die, for example. But they're not going to let RFK through by any hope. I mean, it's good that he's standing because he's bringing all this to the fore, but he's not going to win because the system's totally rigged against him. In a fairer system, he would stand a good chance, but he's not going to win because it's all rigged.
Well, we're also joined in the studio by Bristol freelance journalist Joe Banks. Hi, Joe.
Hi there. Hi, Tony.
Hi. Now, I wonder if you just recycling back to Robert Kennedy talking about housing there and the Acorn people. What do you make of the situation in the city? Because it does seem as if, as I said before, you know, what we've done is we've elected a Labour administration, but they seem to be acting really on behalf of landlords and property speculators, really, rather than ordinary people like you and me.
Yeah, it's pretty odd. I think with this Labour administration, you can actually say that, you know, the developers are in City Hall. One example of that would be the cabinet, the Labour councillor, the cabinet member for planning, for strategic planning, Nicola Beach, who's a councillor in St George's, but when she became a councillor in I think it would have been 2016, was at that time working for a developer's PR consultancy, and was specifically brought in by Marvin Rees because that was what she did. It's a very strange situation because you've got they're telling us that the policy of letting the developers just rip and go for it is the response to the housing crisis. But what they're building isn't affordable, and a lot of times it's not development that's going to create communities. So it's a bit of a mess, basically. Yeah, but at the same time, they're pulling every trick they can.
Well, it's not a mess for the developers. They're rather enjoying all this. I wonder if you've been keeping track on any of the other developments around the city, because, I mean, this is our city's future we're looking at here, the city skyline for the future. There seems to be an amazing complete shift since the days of the previous mayor, George Ferguson, who wanted to put an arena on Temple Island next to Bristol Temple Meads Station, right close to the centre of the city. And that's all now been moved, that arena, up to Filton, up in Gloucestershire.
Although still no arena. Still hasn't started building it yet.
No, that's right. That's right. It's all talk, actually, still. But what has happened is that the university's taken over and Legal & General have taken over that site. They're now doing what they want with it. Any recent developments on the planning scene?
Well, what I wrote a piece last week about what's become known as the Broadwalk scandal, which I spoke about last time I was on the show. And it was this... this U-turn that was done, where you had this development in Knowle, in South Bristol, to replace a 70s shopping centre, and the proposal was for this enormous sort of mixed-use scheme, but mainly housing, that was 850 units at a density of almost four times the specified optimum level in Bristol's local development plan. And it was going to be up to 12 stories high. There was less than 10% affordable housing provided. And that was voted down unanimously by one of the planning committees. And then at the next sitting of that planning committee, where they're supposed to come back, the officers come back with the reasons for the refusal, because those councillors have voted against the original officer recommendation. And then you come back, they offer up the reasons that relate to specific development policies, and then those councillors vote that through, they ratify that. But what actually happened was that you suddenly had this U-turn where the three Labour councillors switched their vote. The Tory chair, Richard Eddy, who basically ran this thing through the committee, he switched his vote, and you had another Tory councillor who abstained. The chair, it was a 4-4 split, the chair got the casting vote, and the thing went through. And some emails have emerged through a Freedom of Information request that show some of what happened behind the scenes, and how this was worked out between the Tory chair of the planning committee, the developer, and Kevin Slocum, the head of the mayor's office, and how they were working in concert to orchestrate this U-turn, basically. And it revealed some pretty extraordinary stuff, not just in the way that a planning committee chair could operate in that way, which is, you know, sort of clearly way beyond the bounds of the supposedly fair and transparent planning system, but also in the manner and in the way this curious chap Richard Eddy was conducting himself, the way he was talking to the developers, he was joking around, being derogatory towards council officers. He was making these straight, you know, sort of odd references to Margaret Thatcher and the private sector. The fact that he's always been a man of the private sector, and he's despite all this, you had the strange spectacle of the mayor Marvin Rees congratulating him on his handling of the planning committee this week in a council meeting, made even stranger by the fact that Richard Eddy has this background of being very odd about race. You know, there was a big controversy about 20 years ago where he made national headlines being photographed holding up a big gollywog doll because he was making a stand against the fact that Robertson's Jam were removing the gollywog doll from their labelling, which he saw as an outrageous example of political correctness. So you had these weird photographs of him outside City Hall sort of gurning at the camera holding up a gollywog doll. And then when the Colston statue came down in 2020, he made national headlines again by making big comments about the fact that Colston was a hero, you know, that real Bristolians venerated him. And yet you get this situation last week where the mayor is praising this guy for his handling of of the planning committee and what he's doing to encourage development in the city.
Well, there's also the matter of an incident, which I'm sure Richard would rather forget about, with an alleged prostitute in a bed and breakfast on Coronation Road as well. So
I did not know about that.
Briefly at the time. But anyway,
politically, the thing with him, he clearly loves winding up Bristol progressives. That's part of his shtick. So he was calling the Greens, last week he was calling the Greens lentil eating amateurs.
Well, the best thing to do with people like him is just to ignore them, I guess. But look, what about this announcement about the merchant venturers moving out of schooling?
Yeah, there was an incredible story this week or last week where you had a merchant venturer's, Martin may know more details than me about this, but where you had a merchant venturer's state school in South Bristol announced the day before term started that they weren't going to be providing A-levels, you know, with students ready to start the next day. And you had a very strong statement from the Green Councillor Christine Townsend at the council this week, decrying again their involvement in schooling in Bristol. And that follows actually a statement from Thangam Debonair, the Labour MP for Bristol West, who herself made a very strong statement a couple of weeks ago that they shouldn't have any place in education in Bristol. So, I mean, I think that the pressure seems to be turning up on them.
Yeah, it certainly does. Let's look at this is basically I think of it really as a kind of journalism story, anything to do with Google, because so many journalists use Google all the time, but they don't necessarily realize that the search engine, and of course it's much, much more, it's also YouTube, it's one of the organizations that tries to control what we see when we type something in on the internet and try and find something. The many, many things that they control and own, of course, many of the free email accounts are Gmail accounts, which I hate the idea of even advertising them. And certainly every show I try and point out that do not use Google Play, use anything else to download your apps, because Google Play insists on certain changes to apps which make them less secure. There has been this year or this week beginning of an antitrust case over in the United States. I mean, I've been off from watching the news. I've been, you know, sort of basically zipping about and on holiday, so I haven't really been keeping a close eye on the news as I normally do. I haven't seen much about this story, but there's been an antitrust case started in the United States, which is basically a class action against Google. And I can remember, literally, this is back about 2017, something similar was started in the States, and I wrote an article about it for RT, and I remember sending it to the woman at RT who had a Gmail account, because she found that the emails from Gmail accounts to her RT account were not getting through. So once she opened a Gmail account, she was starting to get the articles, which were then being published on the RT website. So it's a bit of a convoluted tale, but I sent her the article about the Google antitrust case, or the class action that was happening back then, 2017-ish, and it didn't appear. So I gave her a call the Monday morning saying, oh, didn't you like the article last week on the Gmail antitrust case, the Gmail class action? And she said, what article? I haven't got any article. So this was something which was sent from my email account to her Gmail account, which somehow in the middle of the of Europe suddenly disappeared, or maybe the middle of the Atlantic as it was bouncing over to Google and back. It never appeared. So I sent it to her RT account and it got through straight away. It got through fine. So this is the power that the Gmail Google has. And of course, they can easily get a computer to an algorithm to search through that email. If it's saying anything negative about Google, if so, we want to know. Let's have a look. What are they saying? and they may just, it may just automatically be deleted, you know, so that the email doesn't get through. Who knows? But they don't tell. This is all commercially confidential information. It's rather good to see that over in the United States, the US government plus other individuals are now suing Google in this new antitrust case.
The US government is taking Google to court over antitrust allegations. Prosecutors will argue that the company used unfair practices to become the most popular and dominant search engine by far. Colin Baker explains.
Think about how you search the web. You pull out your phone and type a question. Chances are you're already using Google. There are other search engines, but 90% of the world uses Google to find the information they want. And search is what makes Google and its parent company, Alphabet, one of the most profitable firms on the planet. Here's how it works. You want to find that coffee shop. Advertisers, like the nearby ones, have already put in bids for the keywords you're going to look for. If they've bid high enough, or the keywords are specific enough, their business will pop up first. You might go buy a coffee, but when you click the ad, the coffee shop pays Google a fee. That's Google Ads. But as you browse the web using Google, its cookies and bots follow you, building a profile that will target other companies' advertising on other websites to you. You can turn the trackers off, but you probably won't. And it's all extremely profitable. Google made more than $160 billion last year from the ads in search.
But why does Google often come up first when you purchase a new mobile device? According to the U.S., it's because the company paid Apple, Motorola, Samsung, and others billions of dollars to be the default search option. Google acknowledges the deals, but doesn't specify the terms. The U.S. says that's unfair, so it's using a law from the turn of the 19th century to stop it.
The Sherman Act simply says you cannot have anti-competitive agreements, and you cannot monopolize or attempt to monopolize. That's all it says.
The last time the U.S. government took on a tech company this big was in the 1990s. The target was Microsoft, and Bill Gates had to testify that his company wasn't forcing out competing internet browsers. Microsoft lost. It was broken up, then it appealed and paid a penalty. More than a generation later, Microsoft is now Google's toughest search competitor, thanks to new AI-powered search options in Bing.
I think the reason why now is just that we have a more progressive regime that's willing to go after some of these cases. And obviously this was started in 2020. So it isn't the, you know, the Biden administration alone just going after it. But there's just been a larger push to go after a lot of these tech companies now because they've gotten so large.
Google says it makes a powerful and fair product that helps businesses grow. And if users want to choose a different search tool, they can. But this is just one of several cases the U.S. is making against the giants of Silicon Valley.
Well, Patty Klein is live for us in Washington, D.C. with more on this story. I suppose what we're wondering is what can we expect from this case in court, Patty?
Well, what's happening right now is the attorneys for the Department of Justice and then an attorney representing the more than dozen states that have joined the lawsuit, they've just now finished opening arguments about an hour and a half. Judge gave about a 20-minute break, and so I expect right about now lawyers for Google are giving their side of the case. It's expected to take about 10 weeks of testimony, and experts say it is going to take months for the judge to decide this. It could actually not come down until 2024. It isn't a jury trial, so it's been interesting. The judge has been interjecting questions on sort of legal grounds, definitions, so keeping the lawyers on their toes a bit. But as Colin mentioned, this really comes down to, is Google an illegal monopoly? What's an illegal monopoly? Well, it's a company that's so big that no other company could possibly compete with them. And again, at the heart of this case is that default setting. So we did get a little bit of news in the courtroom today. The attorneys for the Justice Department say that Google spends $10 billion, more than $10 billion a year, to get those default settings on your computer, on your iPhone. Now, Google, for its part, says, look, people use our search engine. We're the dominant force because it's such a good search engine, and people can change their default settings. The answer from the Justice Department as they finished up their opening arguments was, well, if defaults don't matter, then why is Google willing to pay billions of dollars for them? So, again, opening arguments underway. Google up next.
Well, it's still obviously very noisy where you are, but one wonders through all the noise and buzz of what's going to happen, certainly in court, how this is going to impact on the consumer, depending on which way the verdict goes eventually.
Well, experts will tell you this is an absolutely huge, huge case. Just think about how much big tech dominates our lives right now. So the government says if Google, if they win, one of the options that they'll look at is asking the judge to break Google up. That would have a huge impact on Google and Alphabet and all of their shareholders, obviously. But the government also says it would increase competition. Maybe a search engine could break through that maybe has better privacy policies for consumers. It could also lower the cost of advertising. Google has a pretty much a lock on online advertising, and they testimony in court was that they can basically set their own price, so it could make it much cheaper for businesses to advertise. But it's even bigger than that. There are just a handful of really big tech companies that pretty much control our online lives. This could send the message, if Google wins, that the government cannot take those businesses on. If the government wins, companies like Facebook and Meta, its parent company, and all the others, might get concerned that the government's going to turn their attention on them next.
Interesting. Very interesting indeed. Patty Culhane there for us in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Well, this is, they mentioned that was from an Al Jazeera report there. Mentioning the Sherman Act from the turn of the century. This is around about 1900. I think it was actually passed around the time of the First World War. But this kind of legislation in the United States is very rarely used. As he said, in the 1990s, it was used against Microsoft, who was shown to be trying to destroy open source software like Linux, this kind of thing, something called the Halloween Memo back then. And quite clearly, Google are doing the same. In fact, Microsoft and Google had various rival court cases around about 2015 time. And yet they met up and they agreed to drop all the court cases against each other and work as a cartel in order to stitch the rest of us up back then. So I wonder, maybe you first, Joe, what you make of the power of Google. I mean, nowadays in the modern journalistic world and the internet world, they have become ubiquitous, as we just heard there. They have almost an entire monopoly on internet advertising, for example.
Yeah, I find it very sinister. And this is, talking about RFK earlier, something I find so appealing and interesting about him is the way that he... He's tackling this head on and I've heard him talk about it in terms of the monopolies in America in the late 19th century and the way that they had to be broken up.
Let's just be clear. What happened with the Standard Oil was there was this thing that the Rockefellers managed, which was called vertical integration, where they started to own everything, basically all the way from the oil fields to the companies that were pumping out the oil, to the railways which were distributing the oil. In fact, even secretly owning the railways, so they distributed their own oil for free, and any rival oil company had to pay through the nose to get their oil moved around the country, but Standard Oil didn't pay anything. And the other thing is right the way through to the refineries and actually through to the gas stations or petrol stations themselves, which are owned by Standard Oil. And it became quite obvious that they were moving the wealth around within that business in order to avoid tax the whole time. And they basically took over the entire oil industry as a private concern. So the government moved against them. I know one of the things you want to talk about, Joe, is this whole business of BlackRock, which we heard RFK earlier on touch on. But before we hear from you, I'd like to just play... I think she's amazing. Her name is Morgan Marshall. She's on Instagram, which is something I don't use very much, as ITS Morgan FR. That is ITS Morgan FR. That's where you'll find her on Instagram. But she has this to say, Morgan does, about BlackRock. She's a great character, and I think in a way they should put her in charge of one of the big newspapers in the United States, and we'd see a massive transformation in the press over there. Anyway, let's have a listen to Morgan Marshall now talking about BlackRock.
So the CEO of the world's largest oil company has just joined BlackRock. Let me explain to you why this is such a huge deal. So BlackRock is an asset management firm, and they own over $9 trillion worth of assets, set to reach $15 trillion in the next 5 years. Let me put into perspective for you how much money that actually is. So the value of the top 10 richest companies in the whole world combined is $12.7 trillion. And guess who the top shareholders are of those companies? So first on our list, we have Apple. The top shareholders are Vanguard, Berkshire Hathaway, and BlackRock. Vanguard is also another asset management firm similar to BlackRock that owns over $8 trillion worth of assets. So let's keep an eye out for them too. So next we have the world's largest oil company whose CEO just joined BlackRock, Saudi Aramco. I hope I'm saying that right. But top shareholders, number three, the Vanguard Group. And then we have Microsoft, Bill Gates, Vanguard, BlackRock. Next, we have Alphabet, a.k.a. Google. Top shareholders, Vanguard, BlackRock. Everybody knows Amazon, Vanguard, BlackRock. Then we have Tesla. Oh, look, Vanguard and BlackRock. Berkshire Hathaway, which, if you remember, they are the second top shareholder of Apple, whose top shareholders are Vanguard and BlackRock. And I'm going to pause on Berkshire Hathaway really quick because they own so many brands that we would never normally associate with each other. Let's just take a quick look. They've got Geico, Duracell, Fruit of the Loom, Pampered Chef, Dairy Queen, MedPro Group, ABC, Channel 10. And they're also the top shareholder of Coca-Cola, right next to Vanguard and BlackRock. Are you guys noticing a trend yet? Next, after Berkshire Hathaway, we have Meta Platforms, Vanguard, BlackRock. Next up, United Health. Oh, what do you know? Vanguard and BlackRock. And number 10 on our list of wealthiest companies, we have the world's largest video game company, Tencent. Surprisingly, on their top shareholder list, I don't see Vanguard, but I do see BlackRock. And just for shits and giggles, let's see who the top shareholder of BlackRock is. Oh, look, it's Vanguard. I gotta say, I'm not shocked at all. They even own more of BlackRock than BlackRock does. We are so manipulated by the illusion of choice. BlackRock and Vanguard literally are the top shareholders of the top 10 wealthiest companies in the world, and those companies own all of the brands that we see anywhere ever, whose top shareholders are also BlackRock and Vanguard. Let's continue down the list of wealthiest companies, just to see. So number 11 is NVIDIA, Vanguard, BlackRock. Then we have Johnson & Johnson, whose top shareholders are Vanguard, BlackRock, and SSGA Funds Management, which I've seen a couple times now, so let's see who their top shareholders are. It's really me, why did I even question? It's Vanguard and BlackRock. I'm just going to keep going until I run out of time. We've got Visa, Vanguard and BlackRock. Walmart, Vanguard and BlackRock. AP Morgan.
And she ran out of time. You don't need to guess. This, Joe, is a particularly pernicious concept here, isn't it? That you've got Vanguard and BlackRock pretty much owning anything. Conglomo, you might call them, with a giant tower in every city, and their strapline in neon lights flashing beneath it is, "We own you."
Yeah, I mean, it's deeply dystopian, isn't it? I mean, it's like classically dystopian. As so many things emerging around us are.
But I suppose one of the main problems is that often it's our mass media, which is also owned by these people.
Well, yeah, but BlackRock are an incredibly illuminating thing to look at. How the world works. When you also think that they're a long-time holder of Ukrainian sovereign debt. They're involved with Morgan Chase, JP Morgan Chase, in setting up the reconstruction bank that's going to supposedly redevelop Ukraine after this war. When you think about George Osborne leaving government in Britain and going to work for BlackRock for $650,000 a year, working 4 days a month. You don't have to be a conspiracy theorist to see that their tentacles just stretch everywhere.
They certainly do. And of course, one of the things that Morgan said there, I mean, I do love her stuff, Morgan Marshall, on Instagram. is it's just an illusion, Martin. Competition is a total illusion.
It is. I mean, it always was an illusion, but there's further concentration going on all the time. And you might think, why would, you know, Vanguard and BlackRock own both Coca-Cola and Pepsi? You know, surely they should just let, you know, let one die and keep the other one. But of course, what it does is it gives A, the illusion of choice, and B, it leads to a situation where anybody else who wanted to set up in competition with Pepsi and Coca-Cola, they've got to spend all the same advertising money that has already been spent. So a lot of the money spent on advertising is really a barrier to entry to new firms. And of course, the real way in which capitalism actually works is that dominant actors basically stitch things up so that there is no competition. I mean, you know, some businessman some years ago, I can't remember which one it was, says all businessmen love competition. Competition for their rivals and monopoly for themselves. And big businesses in particular use their power of monopoly to monopolise. There's two ways of looking at this. One is the sort of Sherman Act passed in 1900 in the US, which is try and break them up and make them into smaller companies. The other alternative is just to nationalise these monopolies and run them in the public interest. And that, in fact, was the position of the American Socialist Party back in the US Socialist Party back in the 1900s. If we're going to have one monopoly running the railroads, that monopoly should be the government. And of course, there's quite a lot of logic to that, isn't there? Can I just make a further point, which is that the sanctions on Russia mean that BlackRock and Vanguard own nothing in Russia. All they've had to liquidate everything. In fact, but basically the Russian state has, in retaliation for the seizure of their assets, have seized all of those assets inside Russia, which is another reason why, of course, they've got to be destroyed. Carthage must be destroyed. They do have enormous amounts of power, but in certain parts of the world, it's disappearing.
So, Joe Banks, I hope you'll be able to stay with us into part two, Joe, because we're going to have our break now. Do you think you'll be able to?
Yeah, I'll stay, yeah.
Yeah, great. Fantastic. And and just to let listeners know, you'll find Joe's most recent stuff at joebanks.substack.com. I think this is kind of fairly recent that you started this new blog.
Yeah, I'm going to write about... I'm going to write particularly about Bristol planning stuff on Substack.
Substack is becoming the sort of go-to place because it enables people to read stuff, but then also makes it easy for them to donate towards your future work if they wish to, which is one of the reasons that Substack is starting to take off. But just before we have our break, we've got a poem again this week from Patrick Sieropulenza, bless her. An ode to TG's summer holiday. Tony on beach with sand in toes, a holiday in heart now knows. With family to have some fun, a few weeks off, let's not be glum. 2 weeks will pass in blink of eye. Martin, the host, most likely try to fill the space we all may feel until Tony's back with tan unreal. A postcard hope to Martin send. A thought from Bar for T's good friend. Wish you were here, but so glad you're not. Thisweek.org, now Martin's slot. To soldier on with head held high, reporting views and news, no sighs. Dave on sound with heavy heart will do his best, his skills impart. To fill the gaps they all may feel until TG is back to grease the wheels. Thanks, Patricia. I'm not disappeared off the show completely, but you're quite right. Actually, with Martin in the studio on the microphones, he's much more able to sort of, every time he speaks, my voice gets kind of crushed beneath his. So to a certain extent, you're quite right there. But anyway, thanks very much, Patricia. We'll have a break and we'll be back after the break to be looking at some of the stories that I told you right at the very, very, very start. Which include these cruise missiles slamming into the Russian naval base in Crimea.
We are the apart to call my own. It's you who are the only girl in the world, and you are the only one. Nothing else would matter in this world today. We could go on loving in the same old.
Glory, hallelujah. Lord, I have my trials here below. Trouble I've seen, nobody knows my sorrow, nobody knows the trouble I've seen.
Dustbin lid. When he hears the things that you did, you'll get a belt from your dad. Oh, you have your father's nose, so crimson in the dark it glows. If you're not asleep when the booze is close, you'll get a belt from your dad. You look so scruffy lying there, strawberry jam tarts in your hair. In all the world you haven't a care, and I have got so many. It's quite a struggle every day, living on your father's pay. The beggar drinks it all away and leaves me without any. Although you have no silver spoon, better days are coming soon. And Nellie's working at the loom, and she gets paid on Friday. Perhaps one day we'll have a splash when Little Woods provide the cash. We'll get a house in Naughty Ash and buy your dad a brewery. As a dustbin lid, when he hears the things that you did, you'll get a belt from your dad. Oh, you have your father's face, you're growing up a real hard case, but there's no one can take your place. For your mommy.
So, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. Those that want to bypass the psycho in the corner. Music to begin with was We Plough the Fields and Scatter with the Scottish Festival Singers. Then If You Were the Only Girl in the World and I Were the Only Boy, Violet Lorraine and George Robey from 1916. Paul Robeson and Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. Maybe it's just called Nobody Knows. That was from 1945. And finally, Cilla Black with the Liverpool Lullaby, a single, a very successful one of hers, from 1969. So, yes, thanks for bypassing the psycho in the corner on the talkradio.org.uk stream, live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app and at radioquk.com in Camberley, Surrey. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks and me, Tony Gosling, for the next half hour until the top of the hour, 8 o'clock roughly, where we finish. So we'll start, Martin, with this this attack on the naval base, Russian naval base in Crimea, which is pretty serious, it seems to me. These cruise missiles clearly weren't manufactured by the Ukrainians, were they?
Well, the rumours I've been reading is that they were actually Storm Shadow missiles, British missiles.
Yeah, so the Russians aren't going to be very happy with the British, are they?
No, and of course in the British media, they're being quite coy about this. They could be boasting, yes, it was British missiles that hit the bridge. But of course, the next thing that might happen is some Russian missiles might hit the Severn Bridge, because that's the implication if you're going to do around doing stuff like that, eh?
Or else maybe they'll hit the naval base at Devonport, rather that is more an appropriate similar target, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the Kerch Bridge is a civilian bridge, but I mean, the Sebastopol. We're mixing up the bridge and the Sebastopol. Okay, well, yeah.
What's happened is the Russian Navy base in Crimea that's been hit. Yeah. So maybe Devonport might be.
Yes, in principle. I don't think the Russians are going to do anything precipitate, because in actual fact, these are pinprick attacks when it comes down to it. They're there for political reasons to keep the West thinking that there's some hope that the Ukrainians could win, and therefore we're going to give them a load more money. You see, the first Challenger tank went down, take down by a Hornet anti-tank missile, Russian anti-tank missile. At some point, if the Russians do decide to escalate to attacking NATO, I suspect that their calculation will be, we're not going to do something symbolic, we're going to go for it, and they'll go for it big style. But of course, we're living on the edge of this, and most people in this country have not really taken on board that we're going to war with Russia, despite Boris Johnson telling everybody to, you know, buck their ideas up and give them more weaponry, as he was this week in Kyiv.
Yeah, it might be that the Chinese decide that they want to fulfil the role that NATO have fulfilled in Ukraine, so almost a proxy war by China. So the Chinese start attacking various Western interests, NATO interests, etc., almost for the Russians, in a similar way to NATO are attacking the Russians for Ukraine.
Well, I think the Chinese are on a different timescale. They know, they're watching everything very carefully. Did you see, obviously, one of the other things that happened this week is Putin met with Kim Jong-un from North Korea, who came to the Cosmodrome in Vladivostok, and they've basically formed a de facto military alliance. The Chinese are quite happy with this, because, you see, the Russians are already sanctioned to pieces, as are the North Koreans. The Chinese are still trying to play nicey-nicey with the West, for very good reasons. You know, I mean, if they were to break their links with the West, it would have a pretty dramatic impact inside China. So they're quite happy to see Putin and Kim Jong-un get together, and the Chinese can just go, nothing to do with me, Gov. They must have cleared it with the Chinese. But the Chinese are perfectly happy for the Russians to deal with that, so that they can pretend, you know, they can be, you know, they're still, you know, we're still talking to the Chinese. I mean, James Cleverly was out there not long ago, and so on. But of course, nobody's talking to the Russians, because the only thing we need for Russia is regime change.
Let's have a short report now from Al Jazeera about this. Obviously, the go-to channel. We'll hear in a minute from Prime Minister's Questions, where the whole business of Russia and China came up. But let's have a listen now to the Al Jazeera report on Crimea, as a fire has engulfed the shipyard hit by Ukrainian missiles. That's what Al Jazeera says anyway.
The home of Russia's Black Sea Fleet, Sevastopol shipyard on the Crimean Peninsula, on fire. A barrage of Ukrainian missiles and unmanned speedboats were part of an attack on Russia's naval centerpiece in the war. Russia says two ships undergoing repairs were damaged. Ukraine says it damaged a submarine and destroyed a large landing craft. Just days earlier, in a daylight operation, Ukrainian special forces took control of the Boyka Towers, the offshore drilling platforms Russia seized after annexing Crimea in 2014, used since to control the Black Sea. At the opening of naval exercises with NATO countries earlier this week, Ukraine said Russian tactics pose a security threat to wider maritime traffic.
There is a big problem in the Black Sea because of the high concentration of Russian mines. They wash up on Ukrainian, Romanian and partners' shores, including Turkey. It's difficult to predict how the mines will behave. Russia is constantly mining the Black Sea.
Where the counteroffensive may look slow on land, Ukraine will no doubt consider recent naval successes as a way of curtailing what has so far been Russia's stranglehold on the Black Sea.
Sevastopol port is crucial for Russia to transport fuel, ammunition, and personnel. While the Black Sea remains contested, Russia may struggle to replenish major losses. And these latest attacks could embolden Ukraine's effort to regain control of its southern waters. Zain Basravi, Al Jazeera, Kyiv.
Yeah, so the annexation that is talked about there, wasn't really the case, was it, in Crimea? I wonder whether if there's any connection back with the Crimean War from many years ago. But they're saying there that the Crimea has been annexed. It hasn't really, and in fact it was attacked from Kyiv in an attack on the Russian language, which the people in Crimea speak. And so most of the Crimeans decided in a referendum, 95% of them wanted to join the Russian Federation. So this whole idea of framing it as an annexation is just simply wrong, it seems to me.
Well, I think you're right. And can I just pick up on something else in that Al Jazeera report about the Russians mining the Black Sea? They haven't mined. You know who's mined the Black Sea? It's the Ukrainians, to prevent an amphibious landing on the coast of the Odessa coast. That's what's been causing the problem. The Russians have no motive to mine the Black Sea. It's silly, and obviously that was a spokesman for the Ukrainian government, and Al Jazeera just let him say what he wanted to say. But it's just wrong. It isn't the case that the Russians have mined the Black Sea. It's the Ukrainians that have mined it. And then coming back to the whole annexation, I mean, this whole thing just begs questions, doesn't it? They've just had a parliamentary election in Russia, across the whole of Russia, and the four oblasts which have voted to join the Russian Federation also voted, along with everybody else in Russia, in the elections to the Duma. And the initial results seem to show what you might expect, that United Russia has swept the board. Some regions voted for the Liberal Democrats, some regions voted for the Communists, but most regions have voted for United Russia. So they have become, they were always dominant in the Russian political system, but the war has made them more dominant. And of course, these four oblasts, which are now part of Russia as far as the Russians are concerned, they elected their deputies to the Duma as well. And United Russia were predominant in all four oblasts. Of course, that's not been reported in the West. There's just been a full election in Russia. There's going to be another full election in Russia in March for the presidency. But we're presented as a Putin's just a dictator. And it's like they've just had an election with a massive turnout, but it's all manipulated, of course, Tony. They're brainwashed.
It's pretty clear the Russian people and the Crimean people and the people that live in the Donbass support Putin far more than the ordinary British people support our leaders.
That's quite so. I mean, Putin's personal ratings are higher than for his party, United Russia. And the second, the party that came second was the Communist Party, but they've dropped back a bit. They did rather well in the elections in 2019, because they brought me on RT to talk about it. They nearly got to the point where United Russia didn't have 50% of the votes in the Duma, which is the National Assembly, and they might have had to form coalitions with smaller parties, but they just scraped home. But they're now solidly in control. They got more than 50% of the vote that was cast, and they are definitely the government of Russia. And the party that came second was the Communist Party of the Russian Federation. So if the West was ever able to smash United Russia's control of the Russian political system, the beneficiaries would be the Communist Party of the Russian Federation, who take a harder line on Ukraine. The United Russia, led by Putin, are prepared to negotiate. The Communists are not interested in negotiating. They just say to stick it to them.
We're going to go to Prime Minister's questions now, where a question came up this week. Yes, they're back again, folks, after the, well, they call it the silly season. It's almost a sensible season when you don't have to listen to some of these crazy politicians talking, and you're going to hear one now. This is at the British Army's defeat. Can the British Army defeat Russia in battle? That was the question put to Prime Minister Rishi Sunak this week at Prime Minister's Questions.
Lillian Greenwood.
The head of the army, General Sir Patrick Sanders, has said the UK must forge an army capable of fighting alongside our allies and defeating Russia in battle. So why is the government still pushing ahead with further cuts of 10,000 troops to the British Army?
Yeah. Well, Mr. Speaker, again, I'd say to the Honourable Lady, this is the government that has put a record amount into our armed forces, £24 billion. We remain the second largest investor in our defence in NATO. And as we saw at the NATO summit, other countries look to us for leadership. How the armed forces allocate that record funding is a matter for chiefs to make sure that we have the capabilities we need to meet the threats of today. That is a decision that they will make, and we will back them. But no one can doubt our commitment to funding properly the armed forces and ensuring that we keep this country safe.
Now, I don't know what planet the Labour MP for Nottingham South, Lillian Greenwood, is on. She thinks that the British Army should be able to defeat Russia in war, Martin.
Well, you've got to finesse it. What they're saying is in collaboration with our allies. So, in theory, it wouldn't just be the British Army that would be going to war with Russia.
Well, I can tell you one thing. If our allies, or if Britain was to actually really try and start a fight with Russia, our allies might be dropping away very quickly, mightn't they?
Well, if the whole British Army has currently about 70,000, 80,000 troops deployable, at the current rate of kill on the front line in the Ukraine, they wouldn't last a month. And the Ukrainian army is being absolutely decimated. The best estimates are they've lost between 400,000 and 500,000 killed, 75,000 since the so-called counteroffensive began. And if the British Army are sent to charge out through minefields with their Challenger tanks all knocked out by Russian air power, they would soon end up dead. And maybe one of the things that should happen, I'll put this tongue-in-cheek to people, maybe we should send the British Army to the Crimea, because they'd all be killed and the whole thing would be smashed, and then we'd just have to get on with being a middle-sized European country and fix stuff at home. Because all of this fantasy about how we're going to fight the Russians just really doesn't, you know, we're really not capable of thinking, you know, we're thinking way, way beyond our real capabilities. We're a minor power in Western Europe, and we're talking about fighting Russia and China to keep the Americans happy. What does Nigel Farage think? Shouldn't we be looking after our own people?
Well, actually, Nigel Farage is one of the voices against the Ukraine war. Christopher Steele, Martin, is an interesting character, isn't he? We heard from him during the Skripal case in Salisbury, as the person who apparently had penned the Trump dossier, which was used during the last presidential elections over in the United States. What do you know about this guy we're about to hear from, who seems to be flitting about on the BBC with no kind of criticism at all, Christopher Steele?
Well, I don't know that much about him. I know he's a former MI6 officer, but of course, you know, they subcontract a lot of things out these days, so you can carry on working for them, but, you know, you become a consultant and stuff like this. He put together the Steele dossier, which was in order to try and discredit Donald Trump in order to help Hillary Clinton, which was in line with British policy. I think they didn't really want Trump, they wanted Clinton. And of course, he also was the handler for Skripal. He lived round the corner from him. He was the guy that recruited him when he was working for the KGB or whatever it was.
Well, this is the funny thing. We haven't heard anything much from Yulia Skripal or Sergei Skripal ever since this big hoo-ha in Salisbury, where, according to the doctors in A&E, nobody was actually treated for any kind of chemical weapons, anything.
Well, that's right. And it's possible either that A, they've been hidden somewhere, you know, they're in Bali sipping pina coladas, pretending to be somebody else. Or the other quite likely thing is they're dead, like Berezovsky's dead, killed by the MI6. So although they didn't die when they were given what looks like fentanyl, they're too much too dangerous to allow loose. I mean, the Russians have been trying to contact Yulia Skripal in particular because she's a Russian citizen and they want to know what's happened to her because she was engaged to be married when she went to visit her father in Salisbury, and now she's disappeared with her father, and the fiancé is saying, where the hell is she?
Well, there's a couple of key facts to do with this whole Skripal business in Salisbury. One is that Sergei Skripal had just written to the president's office, to Vladimir Putin directly in Moscow, asking if he could return because he'd had enough of being here. If he wanted to see if the Russians would allow him legal immunity from, you know, basically betraying certain parts of, you know, his secrets when he was working with the KGB over there to the British. And he wanted to explore ideas about maybe returning to Russia, which is a bit bizarre. And the other thing is that the attack in Salisbury, the so-called attack, which doesn't look to me much like anything at all other than loads of press and PR and spin, took place on the very first day of the new chief constable had taken over from Mike Veal. Mike Veal was chief constable of Wiltshire until he declared that Edward Heath, the former Conservative Prime Minister who lived in Salisbury, was 120% guilty of sexual abuse of minors, boys, as it happened, sort of young teenage boys that were Ted Heath's preference. And Mike Veal spoke out about that and he was booted out. But the first day of his replacement's job, suddenly the Skripal thing happened. So obviously the chief constable in Wiltshire wasn't really able to deal with it. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Christopher Steele speaking the week before last, I think it was actually, on the BBC, which I just managed to catch. I thought, crikey, it's him. So let's have a listen to see what he had to say about ammunition weaknesses and the lack of ammunition for the Ukrainian army over the proxy war that NATO is waging against Russia in Ukraine.
I think essentially what you've had in recent times is a miscalculation, in a sense, by Western governments who have been supplying Ukraine with a lot of weaponry as the war's gone on. In fact, as the war has developed, Ukraine has become more and more dependent on Western arms supplies and particularly Western platforms. And I think the Western governments have, in a sense, not correctly foreseen some of the trends in the war. And one of those is the trend to artillery exchanges being absolutely critical. And certainly at the moment, with the counteroffensive underway, if the Ukrainians are going to break through, then they need to do so with their artillery superiority. And at the present time, the Ukrainians are firing around 8,155 millimeter shells a day. And that is what the US can produce in about a month. And even the attempts of the US arms industry to increase its production of the 155 millimeter to 24,000 a month is only going to be 3 days' worth. So you can see where this is moving, and it's really quite concerning.
So this is not a case of Western fatigue or a lack of resolve for the fight. What you're saying is that it's quite simply a lack of defense capacity.
Correct. And going back to those 155 millimeter shells, I understand there are only two production facilities for those in the United States for the casings on those shells. And therefore, it's extremely difficult to ramp up production in the way that's going to be necessary. And I think particularly at the moment when, as I say, the counteroffensives at a critical juncture. And we understand on the Russian side that although the Russian defense industries have had a lot of problems substituting for Western high technology components in their weapon systems, they've been pretty successful at producing the basic stuff, in other words, the artillery shells and the munitions.
Chris, if there are countries looking in the inventory and things are bleak, and they are urging a peace process and a return to the table now, how united would you say Western countries are about what that peace negotiation would look like, and how ready are the Russians, indeed, to come to the table?
Unfortunately, I think that it's very difficult to have any peace negotiation You'll see, for example, that the Russian local elections, such that they are now planned to include the four occupied territories or annexed territories of Ukraine. And I think as winter grows on, I mean, one of the other issues is the air defense systems of Ukraine, which are crucial in maintaining the country's cohesion and morale and motivation. And that, of course, depends on Patriot missiles to a large extent. And Patriot missiles are another problem area, I understand, where the Ukrainians are firing off about 150 a month, which is what the US can currently produce in about a year. So I think there are some significant areas to worry about going forward, including energy infrastructure and Ukrainian morale, really.
So that's the voice of Christopher Steele. Martin, what do you make of his analysis of this problem with ammunition there? It's interesting to hear that this guy is quite clearly one of the key strategists still, even though apparently he's left MI6, now working for some kind of private company, his own company.
Well, I think it's he is somebody who makes a living by going on TV and coming out with the stuff he comes out with. He's basically living on his past so-called accomplishments.
They didn't ask him anything about Skripal, did they? Maybe they should have done.
No, well, maybe, yeah, but I mean, obviously, we've covered that a moment ago. What's happened?
If you got the opportunity, I mean, surely any decent journalist would say, well, what's happened to Sergei Skripal? And even if he says, well, I can't tell you, that's better than nothing.
Well, I suppose so, but this is the BBC, and that was basically propaganda, wasn't it? Let's face it. We're not discussing whether the war's a good idea or a bad idea. We're all supposed to be on the side of the Ukraine, and we're all discussing how we can get Ukraine to win, and it's not looking too good. On the point about artillery, the Western powers insisted that the Ukrainians had to attack for political reasons, so they've been throwing people forward, you know, basically just with rifles into minefields under artillery fire and so on. This is why they've been taking such horrendous casualties. And the Ukrainian military then decided that they were going to revert to former tactics, which they were, you know, this is NATO tactics, we've got to take the offensive. And they've started to soften up the Russian defences with artillery fire, which of course makes perfect sense. It's the only thing to do. But of course then you burn through your artillery shells. And the fact is that the Russian military industry, which is owned by the government, is ramped up to full belt. The discussions Putin had with Kim Jong-un, they make Soviet-era stuff. So, you know, they've got masses and masses of 155mm shells for Soviet, Soviet kit. So they can ship that to Russia anytime they want, and that's probably what they were discussing. The Russians have got massive, you know, the stuff I've been reading suggests that the Western intelligence analysis, like Steele, misunderestimated, as it were, the Russian artillery shell capacity by a factor of 100%. So the Russians are actually producing twice as much as they thought they might be able to. And, of course, the Russians are using their artillery to very good advantage. They understand modern warfare. If the whole of NATO turned up mob-handed, the Russians would beat them. Because they're just, you can imagine, the Russian army now is absolutely top class. They've been fighting for 18 months. They've taken 30,000 odd casualties, a lot less than the other side. But fighting a real battle like that is how you learn how to fight. And the British army would turn up, having just been kicked out of Helmand province, kicked out of Basra, and they think they're going to defeat the Russian army. They're absolutely deluded.
Let's also, Joe, who I'd bring you in if you're still around, to talk about the, you know, what you make of all this. I mean, there is also, of course, the angle of the enormous involvement of these massive private equity firms like BlackRock. The idea here is that, a war actually can make you lots of money.
Yeah, it's the military-industrial complex, isn't it, that President Eisenhower warned everyone about. Whenever it was 60 years ago, 70 years ago. But listening to that conversation, it's what really strikes me is the this level of delusion among British, American, Western elites that characterises foreign policy, has done for the last 20 years. And despite all the unavoidable evidence of that, those delusions in Iraq and Afghanistan, Libya, and the rest of it. That delusional thinking, just this fanciful kind of thinking, seems to persist. And I don't see where that, you know, I don't see where that goes here in Ukraine.
No, well, I mean, it seems to me that the sort of US dreams of world domination have been completely boxed in by the superpower opponents, the Chinese, the Russians, and the rest of them. And yet there's this kind of element of denial.
Yeah, no, I think we're in a kind of scary sort of dreamlike state.
Martin?
Yeah, well, denial is not just a river in Egypt, as they say. I think it's really problematic because they've backed themselves into a corner with all of the previous rhetoric. Let me come back to Boris Johnson. Remember him, the blondie one? He's not an MP anymore. He's nobody, really. But he's in Kiev this week lecturing Britain about how we need to send more weapons because, obviously, we're the ones who've let the Ukrainian lions down. And, of course, it's him that led to the war continuing anyway because there was actually a peace deal on the table brokered by the Turks and the Israelis in Istanbul in March 2020. And it was Boris Johnson, then Prime Minister, who went to Kiev and told Zelensky, even if you sign deals with the Russians, we're not going to, which encouraged the Ukrainians to fight when they should have been encouraged to negotiate. And, of course, you can, if you keep doubling down and betting the farm, then you will end up in a war with Russia. Before the British army gets to the Ukraine, the Russians will have destroyed it in its bases in Britain with their missiles. They know where they are. They're in Catterick, they're on Salisbury Plain, they're in various places, and before they even get in the planes or the ships to go there, they'll be dead, because that's how dominant the Russians are. The West simply hasn't got these hypersonic missiles. So if the Russians used a hypersonic missile attack on British defence infrastructure, they would smash it and kill thousands and thousands of people, but we couldn't do anything about it. If we fired our missiles back like these Storm Shadows or whatever, the Russian air defence would knock them down. They are absolutely dominant. If Britain and the West wanted to fight the Russians, they'd have to go away and completely rethink their doctrine, and it would take 20 or 30 years. But, of course, the Russians aren't going to give us 20 or 30 years. As far as they're concerned, World War III is now, and they're going to win it. But there's no understanding of this in the political class in this country. That Labour MP going on about why are we cutting the army and all the rest of it, they are part of the delusion as well. Because there's a kind of insular narcissism of politics in this country. We talk about dominating the world, but actually what it comes down to is little squabbles amongst ourselves about who's going to win the next election, and this is the Labour Party positioning itself as more pro-army than the government. And the discussions which used to happen in the 19th century about can we win this, what's at stake, why are we doing this, just aren't asked at all. We all know that the Russians are evil and we're going to have to fight them. And obviously, because we're good, we're going to win in the end. And we're just arguing about how we're going to do it. Whereas in actual fact, you should be talking about, A, why are we doing it at all? And B, can we win? Of course, the answer to that is we shouldn't be doing it. And B, we're going to lose. We are losing. British military personnel are already dying in Ukraine. I've seen estimates that 10,000 Polish soldiers are already dead in the Ukraine. They've been infiltrated in as volunteers, but they've all been killed.
It might also be useful to round up to talk about the horrific floods in Libya this week. I've heard on the BBC them talking about climate change, but then actually it does look as if the real reason for the floods is the complete lack and collapse of maintenance of infrastructure that's happened since the David Cameron and his chums killed Colonel Gaddafi, who's the president. I mean, he said, well, I always remember him saying something, I'm not the leader I'm not the leader of Libya, I'm the leader of the revolution. So anyway, Martin, what do you make of the floods? Because apparently these dams were designed to allow water through in a big flood, gently, but the thing is there's loads of debris collected in them. It's a bit like probably some of Bristol's stormwater drains. If it came to a big flood, everyone would start screaming climate change, but it might actually be due to a whole load of rubbish which had collected in these drains that hadn't been looked at and emptied for decades. So what do you make of these floods in Libya?
Well, let's think climate change may have played some role, but obviously this is an El Nino year, so this is the sort of thing that happens in El Nino years. And of course, the not maintaining the infrastructure on the dams is crucial, because Libya has become a failed state, and the first thing that goes down the drain when you're a failed state is keeping up the infrastructure on things like dams. I mean, the Libyan government under Gaddafi had built a huge water pipeline to bring water to various parts of the country. And that was bombed by the RAF, and it doesn't work anymore. And then you wonder why people are dying. I mean, these things are, you know, these things are all connected. And of course, no doubt people from Libya will be getting into their rubber dinghies and coming over and saying, give us a job. And that's all connected as well.
It is 7,000 migrants landed in Lampedusa. These have all come over from Libya, being ferried over by the mafia, people traffickers from Libya. So, I mean, this is all as a result of the overthrow of Colonel Gaddafi, who I actually had a lot of time for. If you haven't seen it, do seek out his speech at the United Nations that he made, which was, I think, lasted about an hour and a half. He even talked about they're planning a pandemic, you know, this kind of thing. He was an absolutely amazing guy. He seemed to be privy to a fantastic amount of stuff, and therefore obviously had to be assassinated by the Anglo-Zionist Empire. Then there's also, Martin, I mean, I'm over in Croatia, but in Kosovo, the Prime Minister apparently cannot remove ethnic Albanian mayors. The Kosovo Prime Minister, Albin Kurti, said he does not intend to remove elected ethnic Albanian mayors from their positions in the Serb-populated northern part of Kosovo. Days of unrest have prompted NATO to send additional troops there to stave off violence. And we've heard just this week there's been a bun fight in the Kosovo parliament. Mass brawl breaks out in Kosovo parliament over Pinocchio picture and water toss. An opposition MP splashes Prime Minister Albin Kurti as he's giving a speech. A brawl has erupted in the Kosovo parliament on Thursday. Actually, this is back in July. This is, I thought it was a more recent thing, but anyway, after an opposition lawmaker threw a water from a bottle onto the Prime Minister during a speech. Video footage from the incident, a member of parliament can be seen walking up to Kurti, bottle in hand, while the Prime Minister is addressing the room from the podium. The opposition Democratic Party of Kosovo goes to splash water in his face. But anyway, what this whole business of, you know, in Serbian areas, bringing in these ethnic Albanian mayors, it's obviously going to cause problems. We know these problems have been there in the past, Martin, and you were over there working for CAFOLD, weren't you?
Well, that was in the 90s. Mitrovica in the north of Kosovo is a Serb majority area, so the Serbs in the area don't want to be part of Kosovo at all. They really want to be part of Serbia, a bit like, I suppose you could say, the loyalists in Northern Ireland don't want to be part of Ireland.
Very similar, actually, to what's been going on. I mean, obviously, Serbia is a pro-Russian area, so this could simply be a kind of NATO operation.
Well, I was just going to come to that. They want Serbia to line up with sanctions on Russia. So what's happened here is that the Serb minority in Mitrovica refused to participate in the Kosovan elections because they say, well, we're not Kosovans and we're not participating in your elections. We want to be Serbs. And I suppose you could, in theory, talk in terms of having a repartition of Kosovo so that the Serb majority areas in the north could simply go to Serbia. Well, the Serb position isn't that, because they say that Kosovo is in fact part of Serbia and always has been, so that's not really a runner. But what happened was they didn't participate in the election. So what happened was local Albanians, who were in a tiny minority, they put their people up, and of course they were elected because they were the only people standing, and then they tried to enforce putting them in power. The Kosovo army came in to try and put them in power, even though hardly anybody had voted for them, and then that led to tensions and conflicts. Now, the position of NATO on this is quite interesting, because they didn't take the side of the Kosovans. They said this is provocative, and the reason why they're being relatively even-handed, although in the past they were completely partisan for the Kosovan side, is because they're trying to tempt Serbia out of alliance with Russia. Yeah, because Serbia is surrounded, completely surrounded by hostile states. Not so much Hungary, because they're very cool on the Ukraine war anyway. Croatia, interestingly, although they were very much helped by NATO to ethnically cleanse the Krajina, which I drove through just after it had happened. A million Serbs and something like that were driven out overnight by the Croatian army, even though they'd lived there for over 1,000 years. None of them are going back anytime soon, because it's now part of Croatia and the Serbs aren't welcome there. And what NATO encouraged and supported that ethnic cleansing. Everybody in Serbia knows this, but we think that we were doing good things there, and that's what we were doing. It's just everybody can see the double standards that NATO uses.
Well, I mean, the only thing you can do is look at the Milosevic, the Serbian leader, who was poisoned whilst he was actually on trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Absolutely appalling behaviour towards the Serbs. Now, I don't think that one's going to be forgotten ever by the Serbs. They're not going to trust the NATO countries at all. Listen, though, we're going to finish up by looking at China with our final clip. We'll have to leave RISE and the look at the Lucis Trust until next week. On with Keir Starmer here talking to Rishi Sunak at Prime Minister's Questions about China.
What he says now is totally at odds with the Parliament's Intelligence and Security Committee report of July this year. That set out that the government has no clear strategy when it comes to China, has failed to support the intelligence agencies, and is leaving the UK severely handicapped in managing our future security. This has been raised time and time again. But yet again, the Prime Minister fails to heed the warnings and is now desperately playing catch-up. So will he finally commit to the full audit of UK-China relations, which so many in this House have so long demanded?
Mr. Speaker, as always, the Leader of the Opposition is just playing catch-up and hasn't caught up with the reality of what's actually happening. He talks about the ISC report. Again, if he actually went through it, he would realise that it related to a period of investigations which was in 2019 and 2020. Since then, Mr. Speaker, we have launched a whole new integrated review refresh of our China strategy. It's published. We've put in place a range of new measures, including, for example, the National Security Protective Agency, which is staffed out of MI5, supporting businesses and organisations and being alert to the risk from cyber and from China. But if he wants to talk about foreign policy, Mr. Speaker, he should perhaps reflect on his own record, because this was the man who said he was 100% behind the former Labour leader, a person who wanted to abolish the army, scrap Trident and withdraw from NATO. It's clear what he did. He put his own political interests ahead of Britain's.
Quite surprised, really, to hear Starmer there almost trying to egg on the government to make less and less diplomatic relations with China all the time, Martin.
Well, of course, we had the Labour MP earlier going on about why are we cutting the army. Well, you can see what they're doing. Starmer is positioning himself as the member for NATO. And, of course, it's in his political interests, he thinks, to win over red wall seats and the Tory press to be less hostile to him and so on. But, of course, this political debate in Britain about who can be toughest on China and Russia is completely missing the point that we shouldn't be going to war with China and Russia at all. We're a medium-sized European country. Why are we sending an aircraft carrier to the South China Sea? We used to do that stuff in the 19th century, and everybody remembers it. And that's why nobody has supported our position. None of our former colonies, apart from Australia, New Zealand and Canada, have supported our position on Russia. Not one. Certainly not India, which has massively increased its relationship with Russia as a result of the special military operation. Certainly not Pakistan, where Imran Khan has been removed by the Americans because of his pro-Russian stance as they perceive it. And what really, I'm 63, what really worries me is how delusional political debate about this in this country is. Keir Starmer is trying to out Jingo the Prime Minister, and the Prime Minister is trying to out Jingo Keir Starmer. I wonder what Gladstone would have made about this. about all of this, you know, because he opposed the invasion of Afghanistan in the 1860s. But we never learn, do we? Yeah, because there's a delusionary streak in our culture where we think we can pick fights with everybody and we always win because we always did. And there's no sense of how serious this is.
I think you're exaggerating. I don't think it's always been like that. Certainly the Wilson government was nothing like that. The John Smith opposition leader, he was nothing like that. And in fact, Robin Cook, who was also after John Smith died, he was the Shadow Foreign Secretary. I mean, very important guy in through all. In fact, and Foreign Secretary. So these people were completely different to these characters nowadays. I would look at what's going on as a kind of infiltration of our politics by, I suppose, the Bilderbergers, but particularly in Starmer's case, the Trilateral Commission, which is effectively, as Kit Clarenberg and others have pointed out, the CIA. This is a CIA operation. The American intelligence have now basically got their little puppet. And maybe I think next week, I dug out some footage of Keir Starmer, which I've put up on YouTube, from an interview back in, we've got to have a look at this next week. It was, I think the documentary was put out about 2003, 2004, where it's called McLibel, and it's Keir Starmer turning up as a volunteer barrister to help out Helen Steele and Dave Morris as they were sued by McDonald's. So this is where the legend of Keir Starmer began. But then if you're recruited by the CIA after that, I remember Annie Machon telling us about how she believed that Tony Blair had been working for MI5. And so these intelligence services, as we heard from Christian Gurumurthy on the interview about Sri Lanka, this seems to be working very, very closely with all sorts of dodgy organisations to infiltrate and take over. Joe, I wonder if you've got anything to add about this whole relationship with China and the politics around that, because it does seem to me that it's almost as if anybody that is strong enough to contest what the Anglo-Zionist Empire, the Brits, the Americans, the Israelis come up with, is suddenly turned into an enemy and there's no discussion anymore.
Yeah, well, I agree with Martin. There is this complete lack of self-awareness that we have, and this constant willingness just to be dragged along behind America, we need a lot more realism in our thinking around China, it's hard with Starmer. It's very difficult to always tell whether he is, you know, it's very hard to know what he believes. And whether his positioning is purely, about electoral success next year, and I know he has quite strong links with the American sort of security state, but I find him very hard to figure out what's going on with him at all.
Well, yeah, maybe he's just a kind of lobbyist. Maybe that's what it's all about. Oh, and by the way, the Donbass Voices piece with the Erie Bell, who's a Donbass-born doctor now working in London, we'll have that next week too. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also Bristol-based freelance journalist Joe Banks, and also thanks very much to sound engineer Dave Bozenko. I suppose I ought to thank Patrizia Opulenza too, for her poem, however oblique and slightly incorrect, the idea that Martin was going to be suddenly in charge of the show, not me. But anyway, some amusing little lines in there. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Just follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram as well. You can get to the Telegram chat channel. And do please send me interviews and story tips via the Not the BCFM Politics Show page at thisweek.org.uk. We've been streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokescroft in Bristol on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioviewuk.com in Camberley, Surrey, and live on the glorious Not the BCFM Politics Show app. So if you can restream us live or rebroadcast, just let us know. and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show on the talkradio.org.uk live stream next Friday. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Step inside, love. Let me find you a place where the cares of the day will be carried away by the smile on your face. We are together now and forever. Come my way. Step inside, love, and stay. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. Step inside, love. I want you to stay. You look tired, love. Let me turn down the light. Coming out of the cold, rest your head on my shoulder and love me tonight. I'll always be here if you should need me. Night and day, step in. Say you'll see me again, for I know in my heart we will not be apart, and I'll miss you till then. We'll be together now and forever. Come.